The Senate Committee on Veterans and Emergency Preparation Preparedness will come to order.
The House.
House.
Oh, the House Committee on Veterans and Emergency Preparedness is now come to order.
Am I chairing?
Yes, you are.
Nobody told me that.
You're right.
Chairing, awesome.
You're in charge.
I am. Even though you're the assistant chair.
Colleagues, member of the public, in a few minutes, we're going to receive a series of reports that are coming forth from the Oregon Seismic Safety and Policy Advisory Commission. Before we do that, for members of the public and members of the audience out there, in the Senate side, the Vice Chair generally opens with some remarks, and I'm going to turn it over to Vice Chair Mona Sanderson right now.
Thank you. You know, women had been officially barred from combat in the American Armed Services, but in this current war with Afghanistan and Iraq, there's no front lines, and so the ban on combat was virtually meaningless. And more than in any previous conflicts, American women are engaging with the enemy. They are suffering injuries, and they're even sacrificing their lives. And I like reading portraits written by women and that have been serving in combat. And this one is by Sergeant Paige Bumgardner. She's in the Virginia National Guard. We were by this one base called Ashraf, and it wasn't as busy as it should have been. When there's not a lot of hustle and bustle of everyday life, you know something's up. The first gun truck reported a dead dog on the side with an IED in it. It blew up right behind the truck, part of a daisy chain of three other IEDs that went off. Then we started taking fire from the left all the way down. But we had to keep on going because we can't break up a convoy. So we just kept going through this fire. They had RPGs, and I don't know what an RPG is, and were shooting for the tires and the gunners. A lot of vehicles got hit with RPGs directly into the windows. Once we got through, they tried to hit us with a VBED. But I ordered no one gets close to this convoy, so it was taken out, a confirmed kill. We found an amazing cache of weapons, and there were actually 9 more IEDs, so it was bad. But it could have really been bad. I get in touch with McCulhay, who was the commander, and he was like, bum, I need you back here. And I was like, why? And he says, I need a body bag. And I said, for who? And he said, ski. And my driver froze. And I was like, come on, just turn around. I literally had to talk him through it because that was his friend, too. I went back there and saw McCulhay and Gant, who had shrapnel damage. I got 2 medics to help bandage them up and just be there for him. I was like, where's Ski? I looked in the back, and there was my buddy, completely in pieces. So I got the body bag and put him in there. Then this guy came over, and he just looked at me, and I was like, go get some gloves. And so we did that and cleaned up the truck. I wouldn't let anyone near it because no one else needed to see what we were seeing. We were also escorting a first sergeant and a captain, and I remember during the craziness of everything, the first sergeant came up and tried to take over, and I was like, I'm in control of this convoy. He said, okay, what do you want me to do? And that's how it was. And you know, it sucked because it took that situation for me to get my respect. After that, all the guys were like, I'll go anywhere with you. I'll follow you anywhere. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Unfortunately, when the earth's going to start shaking in a 9.0 earthquake, everybody's going to freeze, too. So with that, I'm going to open a informational meeting on the Oregon Seismic Safety Policy Advisory Commission on behalf of the Senate.
And I will open an informational meeting on the Oregon Seismic Safety Policy Advisory Commission report on behalf of the House.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Senator Boone?
Whoa.
Representative.
I got it.
Oh, no. Betsy Johnson's not around,
is
she?
My day, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Chairs Boquist and Fagan and committee.
I'm glad to be here today and in this kind of unique compilation of two committees. So in late 2010, I was requested by Jay Raskin, a constituent from Cannon Beach, and his friend Ted Wolf from Portland to draft legislation that would create a state resilience plan. This request became House Resolution 3, which we passed in 2011. Many people have been working on earthquake and tsunami preparedness, but the state still did not have a plan. In House Resolution 3, the Oregon Seismic Safety Policy Advisory Council, affectionately called OSPAC, was charged with developing a resilience plan. I never imagined that in just a little over a year, a committee of 170 people representing a wide variety of sectors, from architects and engineers to telecommunications, state and local agencies, utilities, systems, and governments, would meet in 8 subcommittees and work collaboratively to produce a report. This is it. It's 300-some pages that makes the recommendations we will see here today. This plan was even recognized by President Obama, thanks to Yume Wong from Dogami, who made sure he was apprised of House Resolution 3 when she was in D.C. Many of these people have been working on this issue for much of their professional careers, and in fear of leaving someone out, I will make a grand gesture of inclusion with my most sincere thanks and gratitude for a product that resulted in much more than I ever envisioned. But I'd like to call out a few people in particular. First, Kent Yu, who's sitting here beside me, who's the chair of OSPAC. And he took his task very seriously and was an impressive cat herder in the process. He enabled us to present a product on time and under budget. There actually wasn't a budget, but that always sounds good in a report like this. The Jays, Raskin and Wilson, they're behind. Well, one's here. Jay Wilson's here. And Ted Wolf, who's behind me in the audience, who led most of the early efforts and organization. OSPAC council members, of whom there are several in the room, they devoted most of the past year's agenda on this effort with their individual expertise and personal attention. Bev Hall, who's in the back, the OSPAC scribe, who kept it all together and then provided expert editing and proofing at the end. Dr. Althea Rizzo from OEM, Oregon Emergency Management, and Yume Wong from Dogami kept us on track with their scientific focus and anecdotal additions. The Oregon Resilience Plan makes important recommendations for our citizens' future personal safety and the continuation of our state's economy after the Cascadia event. And I look forward to continuing the work on these recommendations as we move forward within the legislative sector. So thank you again and again to everyone. And some of you are back here who participated in this effort. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Representative. Are you going to remain with us?
I will. I'll sit up here because this is his first attempt at this, and I want to make sure he doesn't hide under the table.
Thank you.
So I'm going to turn it over to, I don't know how you have it.
Dr. Yu.
Okay. You're next.
Okay. Slides. I'd like to... PowerPoint, yeah.
And I can't help you with that. Sorry.
And for the record, you need to introduce yourself, and if you want to introduce Mr. Wilson, too, at the same time for the record.
I will do that. Okay. Jeff Bocrest, Vice Chair Moniz Anderson, Vice Chair Fagan, Vice Chair Parrish, and honorable members of the committees. My name is Kent Yu. I'm the current chair of Oregon Seismic Safety Policy Advisory Commission.
My name is Jay Wilson. I'm the vice chair.
On behalf of OSPAC, we want to thank you for giving us this opportunity to present our Oregon Resilience Plan. On the screen, on the left side, that's the cover page of the Oregon Resilience Plan. On the cover page, we explicitly trying to address the Cascadia earthquake and a tsunami. Based on the scientific research from the past 25 years, Cascadia earthquake and a tsunami is the greatest natural hazard facing Oregon. Under the direction of House Resolution 3 from 2011, OSPAC led 169 volunteers in 2012. we completed a 50-year comprehensive action plan to address this earthquake and tsunami. Our intention of this plan is to save Oregonians' life, reduce damage to our critical buildings and infrastructure so that we can protect our economy and preserve our communities. On the screen are the 18 members of OSPAC commissioners, plus Bev Hall, who is our secretary. As you can tell, that OSPAC represents a broad cross-section of Oregon. We have five state agency representations. We have various stakeholders from utilities, banking, schools, building owners, and also we have American Red Cross, as well as public members representing various professionals. Also, you noted that you have two colleagues also on the roster, Debbie Boone from the House side and also Fred Gerard from Senate side. Before we go into the detail about the report, I'd like to make a few acknowledgments. First of all, I'd like to acknowledge our colleague, OSPAC colleague, Honorable Representative Debbie Boone, for your vision. You introduced the House Resolution 3 in 2011 after the Japan earthquake, and won unanimous support from your colleagues in the House. And your vision, your dedication, your leadership made this all possible. Thank you. And also, I'd like to acknowledge the support from our governor, John Kitzhaber, and the encouragement we received from President Obama's senior policy advisor, Rich Reed. Looking back, look at the report we put together over the past 12 months. I want to thank all the previous generations of OSPAC members. They laid a solid foundation for the success we were able to build today. And also, I'd like to thank all the steering committee members, including Jay Wilson, Ian Maiden, Althea, Rizzo, and Stan Waters, and all the members in OSPAC for their participation, commitment, and leadership. Without their help, this process would be impossible. To keep the report stay focused, stay on track in the right direction, we also formed an 18-member advisory panel. As you can see on the screen, we have representatives from both government side, from the executive branch, as well as from the state agency and the legislature as well. We also have folks from federal level providing their support, such as from Bonneville Power Administration, as well as USGS. I'm not going to go through all the names. They are way too long. In addition to that, we also have a business representative here as well from Intel, because this report is about to protect the economy. We have 169 members. We divided into eight groups. And we have those eight groups are earthquake and tsunami scenario group, led by our OSPAC member, a chief scientist with Dogami, Ian Maiden. We have Susan Stewart, executive director of BOMA, also a member of OSPAC, together with former OSPAC chair, Jerry Williams, to lead the business workforce continuity group, to understand the impact of the earthquake on our business community. Because our state also is facing the tsunami issues, Jay Wilson, vice chair of OSPAC, and Jay Raskin, public member with OSPAC, also former mayor of Cannon Beach, led the coastal community group. We have two former chairs of Structural Engineers Association of Oregon, Ed Quisenberry and Trent Nagel, led the assessment of the of critical essential buildings to assess our building performance under the magnitude 9.0 earthquake, and develop recommendations on that sector. And also we have Bruce Johnson, the chief engineer with ODOT, leading the transportation group. We are looking at multimodal transportation network, including airport, marine port, bridges, highways, railroads, as well as the navigation channels of Columbia River and the Willamette River. We have Jared Gonzalez, who is a former member of OPUC, and the Stan Water, the public member with OSPAC, board of director with Port of Portland, leading the energy group. We have Michael Mumo, emergency manager from City of Beaverton, also a public member with OSPAC, leading the assessment of telecommunication sector. Lastly, we rely on two prominent chief engineers from water sector, Mike Stewart with the City of Portland, Portland Water Bureau, and Mark Newsom, the chief engineer with Tualatin Valley Water District, to lead the assessment of the water and wastewater sector. Those eight groups did all the heavy lifting. I want to acknowledge their leadership and the project management. Oregon Resilience Plan is truthfully is a statewide effort. On the screen, as you can see, that we have a very, very broad participation. In addition to traditional earthquake professionals, as I listed over there, Structural Engineers Association, ASCE, Earthquake Engineering Research Institute, Cascadia Region Earthquake Work Group. We also have citizens, NGOs, professional associations, and various business representatives from high-tech healthcare, insurance, food retail, and construction. We also have 11 state agencies, two state commissions, and two state boards, plus 11 public utilities, six private utility providers coming to our meetings to develop this plan. We have 10 local government representatives in our eight working groups. These span from Pendleton all the way to Cannon Beach, from Astoria all the way to Brookings. Very, very broad participation. Also, we have legislators participating in our effort, as well as the federal agencies, such as U.S. Coast Guard, U.S. Army Corps, BPA, and the USGS.
Okay. Now that Kent has gotten through the formalities, this is why we're here. This is the theme of this presentation. We have an elephant that is in this room right now that for the last 25 years has not been addressed in terms of the long-term sustainable growth and development of this state. It's a serious topic that has been evolving in terms of what we know and what we can expect. But clearly, in the last few years, from Sumatra through Chile in 2010, and especially from Japan in 2011, we can no longer ignore what is becoming a bigger and bigger issue for us every year, is that we are not building and growing and rehabilitating our communities to address the elephant that is in the room, and that is not just the Cascadia earthquake and tsunami, but it's really the clock, the ticking clock of that subduction zone and when it's going to release again on us. It's no coincidence that the clock has this presence above the legislative and governor's role here over the state capitol. This capital, which was damaged 20 years ago in an earthquake. And so the emphasis here for us in calling this out is just simply this plan is intent upon changing the awareness and the integration of the timeline of what this clock's purpose is. And 313 years ago, we had this event, and we're well within the window for it to happen again.
So a few days ago, we had a second anniversary of 2011 Japanese earthquake. And in that earthquake and the tsunami, confirmed is 19,000 people died and a few thousand still missing. Now, in Japan, they had a magnitude 9.0 earthquake. They have a very unique, special geological setting, which is the Pacific Plate going underneath the Eurasia Plate. Well, on this side of the Pacific Ocean, we have a mirror image almost. Our Wantafuka plate is going underneath the North American plate, which creates all these volcanoes on the east side. This earthquake, this fault is able to generate a magnitude 9.0 earthquake as well. When we have a full rupture on the Cascadia subduction zone, it's going to affect Northern California, Oregon, Washington, and British Columbia. If we have this 9.0 earthquake, our ground shaking will last 2 to 4 minutes. And the tsunami, following the tsunami, will hit the shore, depending where you are, within 15 to 25 minutes. On the map, what you see on the left side is, as you can see, the south coast is closer to the fault in the south coast. In the north coast region, the rupture, the cascaded subduction is further away from the north coast of Oregon. So it's going to take a little longer, 25 minutes, to hit us. And today, a lot of our coastal communities, they have 100% their critical facilities in a tsunami inundation zone. They have more than 85% of the population, standing population, in tsunami inundation zone. We have many schools, fire stations in tsunami inundation zone. This slide is from the professor, Chris Goldfinger, from Oregon State. What he has done is he's looking at the geological evidence from the past 10,000 years. Based on his research, he found that there were 41 earthquakes over the past 10,000 years affected Oregon. We have 21 events around a magnitude 9.0 or above, involving the full rupture from Northern California all the way to BC Vancouver. And also we have almost half, the other half, mostly centered from Central Oregon all the way to Northern California as well. Their magnitude is, because the rupture is much shorter, so the magnitude is a little smaller. But we're still talking about 8.3 to 8.6 range. On the top essentially represents this thick tick represents the magnitude 9.0 earthquake. Thinner tick represents 8.0 or plus earthquake. As you can see that, earthquake happens in a very random fashion. Some of the intervals is longer than the other intervals. But if you look at it today, 2013, we have surpassed 75% of all the known intervals, as shown in that figure. In 50 years, we're going to surpass 85% of all the known intervals. Last time we had a magnitude 9.0 earthquake was January 26, 9 p.m. in 1700. This earthquake is going to hit us again. It's just a matter of how soon, how big and how devastating this earthquake will be. If you go back to the textbooks, you know, this is sometimes you'll find this textbook, this figure. What you see, all these red dots represent past earthquakes. Let's look at the Oregon. Let's look at our neighbor to the south, our neighbor to the north. Oregon is pretty much blank, you can see. So in Oregon, we have this complacency of living a life without dealing with earthquakes, unlike Californians, unlike folks in Washington State. In 1985, we started a question about the seismicity associated with cascaded subduction zone. In 1993, we were able to incorporate the seismic effects of the cascaded subduction zone into our building codes. Think of this for a moment, okay? Now, as a result of that, of course, we have lots of vulnerable infrastructure in our state. A gentle reminder happened in 1993. In about 11 days, we're going to hit the 20th anniversary of spring break earthquake, which affected the Molalla High School. Thankfully, the school was in spring break, so no casualties happened in that school. At that time, I believe our legislature was in session, and when that happened, and our rotunda had some damage. So this morning I had a brief conversation with one of the senators, and we were discussing the leadership after the earthquake. He was saying that we were talking to among ourselves. What if we have a magnitude 9.0 earthquake right now when we're in session? Who's going to lead our state for recovery? For response, something for you to think about. I just want to use this slide to give you some idea what we're dealing with. This figure is taken from Dogami 2007 statewide seismic needs assessment, which was based on the Senate Bill 2 introduced by Senate President Peter Courtney in 2005. In the figure, what you see is that if you draw a vertical line around 1993, okay, 1993, you can see the majority of our buildings, school buildings, fire station, police station, and the community colleges were built way before that. Those buildings are vulnerable to earthquake shaking. You can replace the Oregon earthquake education emergency facility at the top, replace that with bridges, replace that with telecommunication, replace that with power, water, wastewater. It's the same thing, same story, across the board. That's what we're dealing with.
And aside from the ground shaking and the duration of shaking that we're going to face from this earthquake, the coast is really going to be the area in Oregon that's going to face the severest impacts, both from the level of shaking that the coast will have in proximity to the fault, but the devastating effects of the tsunami. Kent and I and a number of people in this room were lucky to visit the affected area in Japan just months afterwards, and it's made me take this my role seriously in bringing this back and trying to be very diligent and deliberate in affecting change here. And if you look at the number of communities along with unincorporated areas that dot the Oregon coastline, and then look to the right on the screen, you'll see two panels. One is looking at the number of residents that that live inside this zone, and it adds up to be about 22,000 people as of, these are 2,000 census numbers, by the way, but it hasn't grown that much. About 22,000 people actually live inside the inundation zone for an average tsunami. And then it's also got the percentages of the population. And, of course, the North Coast is very high in that regard, but it doesn't underestimate the impacts to the South Coast as well. But what that means of those 22,000 people is those people will be effectively permanently displaced when this tsunami arrives. You know, we mostly work at a life safety level in the work we do around tsunamis in this state, and that's about as much as we've had the ability to do, but we're starting to talk about this need to do more in capacity for after the event, and we're really trying to drive home at the personal level that the level of displacement for people on the coast is going to be a huge issue there.
So... thankfully, you know, our state leaders are very concerned about our widespread deficiencies. And in 2001, Senate President Peter Courtney introduced five bills, which got a voters' unanimous support in 2002, which to address the life safety aspects of our schools and emergency facilities. In 2005, the Senate President Peter Courtney introduced another four bills to address the, to get a hands on the, our seismic needs of the schools and the emergency facilities. And then in 2009, our state established a seismic retrofit program to fund some of the schools and our emergency facilities. So over the past 10 years, our focus has been on the schools and emergency facilities. And in 2007, we had an Oregon winter storm. And from that winter storm, we started a question about our infrastructure performance, such as transportation, telecommunication, as well as our power systems. So we had a workshop organized by Dogami UMAM in 2008 to look at our lifeline performance in Oregon. And also in 2009 also we started looking at our tsunami evacuation structures in our coast, feasibility of building such a structure to address some of the tsunami issues. So all of this, we've been focusing on the sort of life safety aspects, more or less on that front. There was a change in 2011, and the UMA one with Dogami, Jay Raskin, and Ted Wolf, they wrote an article in Oregonian, and they call for a 10-year plan to make Oregon resilient for a big earthquake. So this is the first time we're shifting from the life safety focus to life safety plus resilience focus. The citizens' calls, our leaders listened. And in 2011, Debbie and others in the room introduced the House Resolution 3, and it was passed. And then this House Resolution directs OSPAC to lead and coordinate to prepare an Oregon Resilience Plan to save lives and also keep commerce flowing during and after a Cascadia earthquake. Now, if you go to Google to look for resilience definition, there are many definitions out there. Oregonians are trailblazers. We're unique. We have our unique definition. So I'd like to talk about our definition of resilience. Our definition is save lives, reduce damage and loss to our critical buildings and infrastructures so that we can have a very quick recovery and we can protect our economy and we can rebuild better afterwards. I want to use this figure to explain what this means here. So this graph at the bottom is represents time, and the vertical axis represents our lifeline services from our critical infrastructure and critical facilities. And this horizontal line represents our level of services at a normal condition before earthquake. When the earthquake hit us, what's going to happen? Our pipeline will have damage. Our telecommunication cable will get severed. So we're going to lose some services. So we're going to have a drop right here, right? And because our leaders, quick response and take our Oregonian citizens to respond and recover, slowly we're going to get back to the previous earthquake level. That's us. And if you, the other line we have here is for Japan and Chile. Because they are better prepared, they drop a little bit, but they are able to quickly bounce back. And then, because they were using the better system to replace the damaged system, so after the earthquake, their system will perform much better than what they have prior to the earthquake. Now, Oregon is going to take a long time to recover for several reasons. Reason number one is because earthquake size is 9.0. Second thing is because we have a widespread deficiencies. Most of the facilities, buildings, infrastructure were built before our knowledge of Cascadia earthquake. Third part is the interdependency between all these lifelines. For example, if your water line is broken, what are you going to do? Well, you're going to say, if I'm the water agency, I'm going to send my crew to go there, fix that pipeline. Then I'm going to pump water afterwards. Well, in order to do that, you need roads, you need a liquid fuel to drive your vehicle. Then you need to have roads and bridges able to support that. Then once you fix your pipeline, well, when you pump water, you need electricity. If we don't have fuel, if we have transportation, if we don't have electricity, we won't have water. So those are the interdependencies that are very critical. We try to address this in this report. So because of these interdependency issues, that's why it's going to take a long time for us to recover. And the other thing is also I want to briefly talk about the difference, the relationship between sustainability and resilience. In the past 10 years, sustainability has been a buzzword. I want to say, well, what does sustainability mean? This is the environmental term describes our human impact on the environment. The sustainability index is trying to reduce our human impact on the environment. But think about this, turn the table around. The environment throws bad things to us too. Hurricane, tornado, earthquake, tsunami, flooding. Well, how are we going to address those impacts on our environment? That is through resilience. It's our body's immunity system. If we don't have that, we're in trouble. Now, we firmly believe that if you don't address resilience in the context of sustainability, it's not sustainable. Think about this. If you build a facility without adequate resilience consideration, likely that piece of facility will fail or will get damaged. And we'll get it replaced after earthquake, the energy embodied in that system will get thrown away. So we believe that sustainability without resilience is not sustainable. We have to address them together.
referring to the previous slide, there was the mention of Japan and their ability to come back. And, of course, they're a very seismically active country, and they've got probably the most integrated earthquake protection systems in the world. But in March 2 years ago, they were not prepared for or hadn't planned for a magnitude 9 even being possible off their coastline. You know, and so one of the things that occurred is the earthquake was a problem, but it was not a disaster in many locations because they have such a high level of sophistication in their building codes, their implementation of structural safety and human preparedness too. But the tsunami overwhelmed the coastline. And so they're having to make a shift now to what's their new magnitude 9 paradigm in terms of the level of preparedness and investment and recovery that they had not anticipated up to that time, even for such a progressive country. Well, compared to us, we have so little earthquake activity in Oregon and in general in the Pacific Northwest that we're far from as robust as they are. But we do understand that this magnitude 9 earthquake is in our future. And so it creates a certain issue for us to address is what is it going to take for us to make this magnitude 9 paradigm shift in our culture, at the cultural level? Can we learn from lessons, hard lessons from other countries, or do we have to wait and learn these lessons the hard way through personal experience?
So I just want to also talk about our organizational structure, how we put together this this Oregon Resilience Report. We have OSPAC leading this whole effort. Within the OSPAC, we have a steering committee, essentially manages the day-to-day oversight on our eight task group. Along the way, our steering committee communicates constantly with our advisory panel, make sure that we stay focused, stay in the right direction. Now, within these eight groups, this is a very unique process, very different from the planning process we have done in the past. So at the bottom, we have the Magnitude 9.0 Earthquake and Tsunami Scenario Group, which will define the ground shaking, tsunami inundation, how much ground will move, and all of that. Provide these parameters for the five lifeline critical infrastructure groups. Okay, so they're in the middle, and on the top we have two groups. One is representing the business group, business community. The other one is related to the coastal community. These two communities will define what they need from their business continuity perspective, from the community recovery perspective, what they need. Provide these targets for these five working groups in the middle to figure it out what would be the desirable time frame we need to restore those services in their sectors. Okay. So because the earthquake fault is further away from, as we march along to the east, you know, so we anticipate that the earthquake damage will get less and less. We decided to divide our state into four zones. At the coast, we have the tsunami inundation zone. That zone, you know, from the TV broadcasting from Japan, you know that that region will be devastated. So our main focus in that region is to save lives, get the people out of that zone. Okay. And the second zone is coastal region above the tsunami inundation zone. Over there, we have to deal with the how to keep the people sheltered, keep the people fed in that region. What happens is this: because they're closer to the earthquake fault zone, they're going to see very intense shaking and very long shaking because of their geologic formation. They are going to have lots of landslide. With landslide in place, they're going to affect the 101 or the transportation network, which means lots of communities will be isolated. Okay, so we have to figure out a way to keep the people sheltered, keep them fed. We're not only dealing with the people, the standing population. We're also dealing with the tourists. In the summertime, we have three or four times of the standing population in the coast. We need to think about that. Then in the I-5 corridor, Willamette Valley region, that's where we have most of the population. That's where we have the most economy. In this area, our focus is how can we quickly restore the critical facility so that we can we can have an economic recovery so that we can preserve our communities. If our people leave this region, we're going to be in trouble. East and Central Oregon, they're going to suffer relative light damage. We are planning to use that region as a staging area. We are relying on the Highway 97 to connect our state with our neighboring states, and we are using the airport in Redmond as the main relief airport to bring in the goods and personnel into our state. We're going to migrate from the central eastern Oregon to a valley to help recover over there. Then we're going to go to the coast. That's the regional interdependence we try to address. So for seven task groups, we ask the those questions, ask our task leaders to look at the what is the performance of their facility in their sectors. If we have earthquake today, and assess how long will it take to restore their services. This is today, okay? Then based on the business community, based on the coastal community, their business continuity needs, based on their community recovery needs, they give us the resilience target. And from there, we can figure out how long, what's the time frame we needed to restore all these functions. Essentially, for water, wastewater, for transportation, what is our desirable restoration time frame? Now we know where we are today. We know where we want to be if our state is resilient. Then we can figure out other recommendations how to get point A to point B. That's all that is. So after 12 months of working, I'd like to share with you our key findings. First finding is no surprise to you all, is Oregon is far from resilient to the impact of Great Cascadia earthquake today. We're going to have significant casualties, fatalities from earthquake shaking, as well as tsunami inundation. And we're going to have significant economic loss. At least we're looking at 20% of our state GDP. And because of the damage, because from the earthquake shaking, because of the damage from the tsunami inundation, we're going to have 10 million tons of debris we have to deal with. During the course of all of that, we found we have a vulnerability related to the liquid fuel. Liquid fuel, everybody needs liquid fuel. We asked ODOT. I said, if you need to restore roads in a condition that everybody else can deal with their restoration, they said, we need a liquid fuel. And where is our liquid fuel right now? Liquid fuel that's sitting on 6-mile stretch near Lower Willamette River. Our fuel comes from Washington through a 14-inch pipeline and temporarily stored over there, all these tanks. These tanks, some of them are really, really old. We're looking at 80 to 90 years old, and they're sitting on liquid fiber soil. If we lose liquid fuel, we are pretty much disrupt all the response and recovery. And the other thing is also, we talked to the business community representatives. What they tell us is that the business can tolerate 2 to 4 weeks of disruption of critical services. 2 to 4 weeks. After that, business may choose close their business or move their business elsewhere. What does that mean is that if they move their business to somewhere else, when the job vanishes, people will move. Today we are dealing with knowledge-based economy. If we lose our people, it's going to be really, really difficult for us to recover, right? So 2 to 4 weeks, keep that in time. That's the target. Look at where we are today based on our findings. We have a huge gap here. Electricity in the valley is 1 to 3 months, coastal 3 to 6 months. And drinking water in the sewer in the valley is 1 month to up to a year. You know, I can live without electricity maybe for a week. I can use a propane tank to cook my food. But I can live without water for more than 3 days. You know, we have many high-tech industries in Oregon. Intel, Genentech, those companies. They rely on water to manufacture their products. If we don't have water, they're done. We need to think about that. What's the impact on our state economy? I'm going to turn this over to Jay.
Oh, thank you. Yeah. Well, one of the things that came out of this, the findings, and it's one of the other main themes, is just how complex all of these interdependencies are. And I think this is one of the things we knew that buildings would break, that roads would be damaged, but we didn't understand how tied together these were in terms of initial response and recovery of this overlapping need for these systems to work together. And it's one of the key findings that's been mentioned. But in looking at these systems and pieces of systems, we also tried to move away from only describing damage to talking about what those damage means. What is the impact from the damage? And that's a big distinction from all of the kind of reports that we've had prior to this. This report's been labeled in the press as kind of a doomsday report. And I, you know, as we're sitting here going through these slides and I'm facing these two committees, you know, I get it. I know this is hard information to swallow. It's a lot to bear. It certainly was not an easy report for us to live with and bring to you. But, you know, in talking about the impacts to our society, we're looking at this long-term way to approach this, and that's where we're getting to. I guess one way of looking at this in terms of making decisions is really trying to differentiate costs. What does it cost to repair or replace a critical building versus what does it mean to lose the capacity of that building? If you've got a key bridge for a coastal community or along the Willamette River, it may be, you know, in millions of dollars, tens to $100 million as a repair or replacement. But if that bridge is down immediately after an event, and it's going to take months to get it either operational or replaced, the capacity you've lost well exceeds the value or the cost of that replacement, and we want to make that distinction. And so putting off repairs until after this happens, you're really shortchanging your communities at the time when they need that capacity the most. A school that provides immediate shelter and then lets children return to school afterwards so their parents can go to work. If that school is collapsed and inoperable after the earthquake, it's not just the $30 million or whatever to fix it. You've impacted the entire society by the loss of that capacity. And that's an even bigger issue than just the cost of the structure. And so that gets into this idea about value. Value means a lot more than just the replacement cost. There's also a bigger value to what it means to have strengthened structures and investments in our livelihood after this event. A quick slide just to illustrate the interdependencies. This is a shot from Japan, and it may be hard to see, but underneath this roadbed, it's co-located with at least four sets of pipelines and conduits that probably represent water, wastewater, fiber optic systems, electrical transmission systems, any number of those. And this is often the way all of our bridges act as conduits for much more than just traffic across rivers. And a single bridge can take out a lot. This is an example of the network that we have for water systems, sewage systems, electrical transmission systems. I mean, this one picture says a lot about what we mean when we say interdependencies and the need for us to think about this systematically. And for the coast, these interdependencies are even more critical because the tsunami inundation zone is where much of our coastal infrastructure is built. This is a community called Minami Sanriku in Japan. It has a hospital, its police headquarters, a major department store, their operating center, and a lot of their residential neighborhoods in this area. No one can live in this area anymore, but the capacity to deal with the crisis is also vanished in this community. And it's one of the reasons that we're really emphasizing the need to move our critical infrastructures to higher ground on the coast and also start planning seriously about how we're going to recover parallel to all of our other efforts right now.
So, you know, we give you all these bad news, but I think it's not all about this bad news in this report. This report is about action plan. We give you recommendations, give you action items for our state leaders to act upon. We would like to share some of the overarching recommendations with you. Number one thing is we recommend establishing a state resilience office to provide leadership, resource, and advocacy and expertise in implementing this statewide resilience plan. Think about this. We're dealing with many moving parts. All these lifeline sectors. When you're playing football, you need a quarterback. That's what I'm talking about here. We need to have this office to coordinate with state agencies, local government, be an ambassador to the private business, And also, we need to check our progress over the next 50-year timeline, because our election cycle is much shorter than 50 years. We want to make sure that we have continuity in our leadership so that we can make sure we are progressing along as we go on in the next 50 years. I know you guys are dealing with day-to-day activities. Sometimes the hot button issue will overshadow this long-term issue. So if we have this office in place, this office will come to talk to you on the beginning of each session, report to you where we are standing today, so that we can keep the 50-year goal in view.
Sure. The other thing that we say is tantamount is having a proper assessment of the level of vulnerability that we have right now. We can't really start doing any implementation until the systems that we have across the board have the ability to come in and really assess the intrinsic risk that they're facing and the cost of repair and the long-term incremental strategy for implementing those things, whether that's the transportation, energy, or wastewater areas, as well as our schools. We've also got this portion of the report that really advocates for capital improvement planning. And this goes on all the time. You know, the state, the counties, the municipalities all have long-term capital improvement plans. But what we're saying is that this report needs to be at the top of the list of things that are reviewed annually in terms of your budget and your spending and your decisions. Long-term decisions for investments need to tackle what is it in your system that's weak to this event? And if you can make those changes now, as you do these on an annual basis, it's much more cost-effective to fold in seismic strengthening when you're in there doing other work than trying to do it independently. And so simply making sure that we're doing that and addressing it from a policy standpoint, from a practice standpoint, it makes this whole effort much more cost-effective in the long haul rather than trying to do a lot of this overnight. It's much more overwhelming if you think about it that way. We've also got to reach out to the private sector and find incentives for building owners, for businesses, to find the purpose in working for seismic safety for their own behalf, for their customers, for their residents, to help them find ways to generate interest in the banking and lending community here. And then also the public policies in general, which is what we're here to advise on. We need leadership. That's one thing that even if there's not any money available right now, having elected leaders, community leaders, business leaders all take this on and say that this is part of their platform, part of their business model. This is one way to ensure that we keep this moving. So 50 years is the timeline we've created for this report. And the purpose being that we think it's much more practical to view this as a marathon rather than a sprint, as one way that we can hand this off from generation to generation so that we're not being hit too hard. And at the level of community planning, we really believe that current plans that are in place, like comprehensive plans, mitigation plans, these are ways that we can drill this into the annual work that we're doing already. We advocate working collectively with our sister states, especially Washington State, which is doing a similar 50-year resilience plan right now. And then human resilience is also a key here, because we need to enculturate this idea that this event is possible and find ways to strengthen our society in terms of their level of personal and household and neighborhood preparedness as well. And then, of course, the civic infrastructure is the backbone for all of this.
So how do we do it? So how do we eat an elephant? This elephant has nothing to do with the Republican Party, by the way. So we said one bite at a time. So we got to, so to address this issue is we need to know exactly where we are standing today, and also we need to take care of this business issue, this elephant, on a daily basis. So how do we do that? There are several ways I can offer some, share some thoughts with you. One idea is you can always tie these, some of the seismic improvement with your capital improvement projects. You know, every 15 years, you're going to replace your roof. This is a good time when you replace the roof. This is a good time for you any additional nails, any additional straps to the building. Also, the second idea is the build right in the first time. Don't go back to retrofit. Build it right in the first time. So we have many aging infrastructure, whether they're bridges or power or telecommunication systems. You know, when we replace them, we do the right. Think about this. I want to give you some tangible example here. You know, when you build your home, you use plywood. You use the nails to attach your plywood to your wood studs. You know, you put a nail 6-inch on center. That's a cost. You said, well, I don't feel that's enough. You put additional nails to it. Now they are making nail spacing 2-inch on center. How, when you do the first time, how much does it cost you to do this before you put all the finish on your building? It doesn't cost a whole lot. When you do the right, you can absorb all these costs, making your system more resilient. The third part is, I firmly believe, is a public-private partnership. You know, no government can take on this cost by itself. No way. Think about this. This is about economy. This is about a business. It's about a community, you and I. So I think everybody needs to work together, bear the cost. I want to give you some examples from other places. You know, the San Francisco Bay Area, East Bay Municipal Utility District. They assessed their water system, and they found that there's a deficiency in their system, and they developed 4 levels of strengthening schemes. And for each level of scheme, they always have a cost on that, and also there's benefits associated with this. They talked to their business people and the local residents. After 100 presentations, 90% of the people actually supported one of the strengthening schemes. So that was in 1994. In December 2011, I called their chief engineer. They told him that they were working on their last project. So it's the same thing. We need to have a conversation. You know, we need to work with the private business. They all need to support it, what we're trying to accomplish here. So I'd like to share a few resilience in action very quickly. Okay. So when we do all these, address all these resilience issues, of course, you know, number one thing is you're thinking about that. You know, we're not only protecting existing projects, existing jobs, also we're creating new jobs and the stimulate our economy as well. So we have in the coastal community, we have three places that are already addressing tsunami issues. Waterport High School, they're rebuilding it above a tsunami inundation zone from Lincoln County School District. Seaside, they have already hired a design team to design a new campus above a tsunami inundation zone. Cannon Beach has already authorized their city council to purchase 55 acres to expand their city limit so that they can build a new school above a tsunami inundation zone. Okay. Schools. You know, because of the state seismic retrofit fund, we're able to already, in the past several years, we're able to fund 25 schools. We're going to protect more than 8,000 students' lives. This is significant. Portland Public Schools, we have some representatives here today. They're going to talk about their experience. They just passed a huge bond, close to $500 million to retrofit their schools. And Oregon University, they have retrofit many of their schools. And also want to share with you, the seismic program also has addressed some of the critical facilities in our state. Tualatin Hospital, some of the fire stations throughout the state, you can take a look at it. City of Portland has almost retrofitted all of their fire stations. Tualatin Valley, Fire and Rescue, also they have an ongoing program retrofit their fire station to meet the resilience goal. ODOT is working on the tsunami issue as well. This is a Spencer Creek Bridge. Is able to resist the tsunami. And City of Portland, they are also building 50 million gallon reservoir, brand new reservoir, to make their water supply system more resilient as well. So I just want to end, you know, our presentation with some good news. I don't want to end with this talk with all these bad news.
Thank you very much, representatives. Questions.
Senator Elskabal. As I've looked into the 64 earthquake in Alaska, and that, I believe, was an 8.6 on the Richter scale, how is our coastal communities going to survive a 9? You're not going to have any infrastructure. I doubt if you'll have any road left intact, and a lot of these communities will be cut off with not only from the outside, but also with electricity. And, of course, water, we can find water in the hills, but I'm just wondering how we're going to approach that devastation, because that would be the whole coast.
Thank you for that question, Representative. There's been a lot of research along the Oregon coast for just this issue, both to assess the vulnerability, but also to use that as the basis for doing life safety levels of preparedness and training, and communities, like we mentioned, that are moving their schools to high ground, trying to get their critical assets out of the tsunami zone. I mean, the level of devastation is going to be almost absolute there. But the ground shaking will damage some structures, but a lot of structures that are built more modernly will likely at least be habitable and potentially livable after the earthquake. But the issue about the tsunami zone is what's most critical, because anything that's in that zone is no longer going to have any service for the community. It's one of the reasons we're trying to advocate for relocation rather than rehabilitation of those services.
Follow up, Mr. Chair. Now, if I understand it correctly, 8.6, if you go to 8.7, it's 10 times more than 8.6. Is that correct? Is that the way that works?
I'm doing this in my head, because normally I only go from 7 to 8. That's 33 times. Yeah, I think probably you're right. Yes, go ahead.
So in other words, if we went to 8.7, that's 10 times more. 8.8 is 10 times more. 8.9 is 10 times more. And 9. So you could have an extremely horrible, horrible earthquake there.
Yeah, the most of the of what's being measured in the those larger earthquakes is the level of shaking pretty much reaches a maximum level of shaking is how long it shakes. That really is where all of that energy happens and translates into damage.
Well,
and that's where we go
minutes.
In. Minutes.
4 minutes.
Minutes of shaking, yes.
Well, I would just address really briefly Representative Esquivel. Along the coast, many of the communities have their own local plans that they're doing, their escape plans, evacuation plans, what to do. They've got, for example, in Cannon Beach, they bought containers from truck containers or train containers to store supplies in, and they're up in the hills at caches with food and prescription drugs, things like that, that people will need. We will be out of power. We will be out of our systems. But a lot of, like somebody said that, you know, up in the hills you can find some water. That's true. But without power, what we're trying to do is create some local power sources that can be quickly turned back on, both in ocean energy, tidal energy, some wind facilities, you know, what doesn't fall down. But we are definitely, the message is forget about that 72-hour preparation point time frame and expand that to 2 to 3 weeks of supplies, and that people will be on their own. Fire districts are not going to be able to come to your house and help you. It'll be devastating for sure. But if you take the message that in 50 years we want to have all the main buildings, those public buildings, up above the inundation zone, more and more people moving up there. And I try to put a positive spin on this, because all this can mean jobs, too. There's a lot of construction jobs, a lot of work jobs.
Representative Boone, let's hope it doesn't come to that for
okay.
Stimulus.
I'd like to add to what's been said already on this. You know, we engineers know how to engineer structures and infrastructures, buildings, and all of that. I went to Japan with Jay, you know, 3 months after the earthquake in Japan. We landed in Tokyo. We took a high-speed train to Sendai. You know, when we walk out of the train station, everywhere is business as usual. I can tell you, I want to use one example to tell you it's doable. And so only we see the devastation is in the tsunami inundation zone. It's all quiet. It's all dead. But right, you as soon as you leave the tsunami inundation zone, it's back to business. It's doable. And I want to give you another example. It's Chile. Chile in 1960, they hit a magnitude 9.5 earthquake. This is the strongest ever recorded in the history. In 2010, they had a magnitude 8.8 earthquake. I was there too, 2 weeks afterwards. You know, I have described their performance in the executive summary in the report. They were able to restart their commercial flight after 10 days. They are able to restore 90 to 95% their telecommunication and the power in 2 weeks. It's doable.
50 years.
Yeah.
2 years.
Any other representative questions for the doom and gloom committee here?
I was just going to mention the Titanic, but I'll pass on that.
Oh.
Just to be optimistic, the Titanic, if you don't know, had a sister ship who had a long and glorious career.
There you go.
Senator's question, Senator Olson.
Thank you, gentlemen, and Representative Boone for the fine work you've done. It's rather interesting you talked about the infrastructure that we need to have. I would ask this question. If a 9.0 earthquake hit the subduction zone, what would the effect be in Portland? What would the quake effect be? Would it be a 6.5, 6.6? The reason I'm asking is our new bridge that we just voted on is only designed for a 6.6 earthquake, and if we build it and it falls over, we're in deep trouble.
Okay. In Oregon, we are facing several earthquakes. Okay, one is the several different types. Cascadia is only one of them. Also, in Portland region, we have a local crustal fault called a Portland Hills Fault, and oftentimes when we design structures in Portland area, actually, the controlling design parameter is based on local faults because they're closer. You know, think about the magnitude 9.0 earthquake on the coast. It's going to rupture for 600 miles or 700 miles. The energy will spread over a very large area. But if we have a local fault, Portland Hills Fault, it's very shallow. It dump all these, you know, 6.5 or 6, up to 6.9 magnitude, somewhere in that range. The energy over there, it's going to create intensive shaking over there. So oftentimes, I tell you this, when we design buildings in Hillsborough for Intel, design, you know, buildings in Portland for retrofit, yes, generally it's the local fault actual controls.
So, follow up. So what you're saying is if there's a 9.0 on the coast, we don't have to worry about the new CRC falling over.
The CRC, I believe the ODOT has taken into consideration both the local faults and Cascadia 9.0 earthquake, and I believe they designed this structure with the resilience in mind. I think this bridge should be okay, in my mind.
And one more follow-up.
Last follow-up.
What would the tsunami effect be of a massive tidal wave coming up the Columbia River?
Columbia River? Maybe I should defer this question to Ian Maiden, the chief scientist with Dogami. But my recollection is that it doesn't go all the way to Portland. It's going to a couple of miles beyond the Astoria Bridge. Is that correct, Ian?
Correct.
Thank you.
Further questions on the Senate side? If there's no further questions, I appreciate it. The only ask I have, Dr. Hughes, is after we get through, the House gets through their hearing bills and the Senate gets through, we're going to come back to this issue later in May and June, and as you and I discussed before, at that point we might want to ask some of the experts chapter by chapter as we kind of work through this and see what is the first bits we need to advance on this at that time, and that doesn't require a bill on either side. It requires bringing the agency and the people into the same room at the same time and saying we need to start advancing this direction. So that's the only ask I have.
And if I may, Senator Boquist, I have a bill that could be used just for that too. It can also it calls for bonding for seismic upgrades, but that's the intent.
Thank you very much. I appreciate it, Doug. The next panel we're going to ask to come up, and I'll just remind the public because we have some members that have other committee obligations later on. But I'm going to have the additional perspectives panel come up. At least John Dottier, hopefully I'm pronouncing this, Marilyn Nicholas, Sue Graves. If you would come up. And then following them will be C.J. Sylvester and Edward Wolfe. We do have some time constraints here, but some of the committee members will try and stay, and this, of course, will be on live TV so everybody can see it elsewhere.
Chair Boquist, Vice Chair Moines Anderson, and Vice Chair Parrish, and honorable members of the committee. I'm John Dodier. I'm the Chief of Facilities Management at the U.S. Department of Veterans Affairs Medical Center in Portland, Oregon. We've got about a dozen campuses, Portland, Vancouver, and others around the state of Oregon and in Washington. And I wanted to just give you a five-minute introduction or summary of resiliency at the VA and what we do to ensure that we can continue to give care to patients, to veterans. The first thing that we do is we're not complacent. Anything new that we build it to a higher standard. You know, it'd be wrong to build it to a lesser standard or to a current standard. In that, you know, a future generation would have to come and retrofit it. That would be money poorly spent. We also always continuously compete for projects, and projects are awarded around to VAs based on workload and based on the unsafeness of your buildings, and we continuously compete for those projects, for seismic retrofit projects and so forth. And because money only comes slowly, we're always preparing for emergencies, and preparing for a seismic emergency also helps us prepare for other emergencies. We've got a 96-hour plan, as we're a healthcare facility, and the plan includes our generators to provide electricity, fuel on station, Portland, Vancouver, to provide for those generators, water tanks, wells, pharmaceuticals, and so forth, to make it 96 hours minimum. That's what is required of a healthcare facility. And but I will say that beyond the 96 hours, and we can go beyond that if we conserve. And if we're creative, and we are creative people, I've got electricians and plumbers, even though we're federal government employees, we are creative.
We appreciate that.
Thank you.
And we recognize that.
Thank you. But we are very, very dependent on the outside world. We're very dependent after that short period of four days to 2 weeks on utilities from Portland General Electric, from PGE, Pacific Power, the roads to get fuel to the campus, the food providers and so forth, and the rest of the private sector. And we're very dependent on the outside world after that short period of time. We always use our events, any events that happen to us, as training for the big one in the future, and we feel that training for the big one helps us meet the small events that come in every day. And you know, we have a car fire in our garage. That's a big event for us today, and we practice and use it for training. We do after action in order to improve our response for future events. You recollect that recently Portland had a boil water notice for west of the Willamette River, and our Portland campus west of the Willamette River, and we used that opportunity of not being able to use the water as a training exercise, and it will improve our response in the future. We also monitor other people's mistakes. You know, during the Sandy hurricane recently, there was a story about a hospital that had to be evacuated because its generator went down, and we investigated that to see if there was any lessons learned from that story, from that issue, to see if we could apply them to our own facility. That's all I have for the group at this time. Do you have any questions?
We'll go through the whole panel.
Okay.
Go ahead, madam.
Chairman Boquist, Vice Chair Parrish, and honorable members of the committee, thank you for this opportunity. My name is Marilyn Nicholas. I am here today representing the Oregon Continuity Planners Association, which is about 250 companies represented by business continuity planners, disaster recovery, IT recovery folks, and emergency response professionals. I'm also here representing InfraGuard. I've been president of the Oregon InfraGuard for the last few years, which is the FBI arm, or the private sector arm of the FBI, trying to mitigate cyber risks in the region as well as other risks in the region. And I am chair of the Private Sector Committee for the Oregon Emergency Management Association. Our goal there is promoting public-private partnership throughout the organization and throughout the region. I've been asked to tell you a little bit about my day job. I have been working the last 25 years, since January 13th of 1988, on building disaster resiliency in Oregon and across the country. I have built business continuity programs in both large and small organizations, a few of which would be U.S. Bank, Pacific Power, Standard Insurance, and others in Oregon, and then others across the country. I also manage the continuity of operations plans in 19 of our counties in Oregon. For me, building resilience in the region is key to both keeping our big and medium-sized businesses here after a Cascadia event, as well as attracting new business to Oregon. Most large and many medium-sized businesses today have already invested in continuity programs. It's a huge investment for them. Developing a continuity program for an organization requires deciding and determining what your mission essential functions are, what resources are required to execute those functions, developing succession plans, developing delegations of authority, looking at what alternate sites would be good sites to go to, especially if their primary work location is not a seismically favorable spot. And also developing IT recovery solutions. Part of a program is also having a risk mitigation strategy. So not only are they planning for being in response mode, but also what can we prevent so we don't have to respond at all. And then also the last piece, which is a very important piece, is personal preparedness. Most of the big business continuity programs I've been involved in also promote personal preparedness. So they require their employees, especially top-level employees, the decision makers, to have kits at home so their family and themselves can be prepared at home, and then they can be more quickly responding to the event. Knowing that the investments and efforts are being made in the private sector, I believe anything we can do to protect those investments is good for all of us. Businesses rely a lot on other services to stay in business, which of course is what we want them to do. They rely on infrastructure to get their employees to work, to communicate with business partners, suppliers, to their employees. Businesses also rely that our kids are in school so their parents can come to work. They rely on food being in the stores so they can take care of their families. They rely on electricity being in our homes, hospitals and doctor's offices open so that they can take care of issues, especially after a regional event like the earthquake we're discussing today. Insurance companies up and running, and so forth. They also rely on water, as we spoke earlier, to occupy buildings, not just doing production, but we also cannot even occupy buildings without running water. Soon it does become clear that we are all in this together. I look at resilience a lot like a wellness program. Several years ago, if I were here talking about wellness incentives for healthcare, I mean, it was unheard of, right? That wasn't a common discussion. And then one day someone realized that we could save a lot of money promoting wellness and preventing disease than for just paying for the response and recovery costs of a health disaster. I believe preventative healthcare, I know preventative healthcare is now integrated into all of our programs, and I believe that we need to do the same with resilience wellness. You know, that eventually it will become part of our culture, just like wellness programs in healthcare, and that will enable us to rebound quicker from an economic disaster, just like today it helps us rebound quicker from a healthcare disaster. I would like to see us be proactive. I hope that we can find incentives to encourage large and small businesses to build business continuity programs if they don't have one today. Some incentives could be reduction in costs of insurance or other types of incentives. And let's also invest in the infrastructure. And we can use those state programs that we develop at those preparedness initiatives to bring other companies to Oregon. Preparedness and resilience initiatives, if that is part of our culture, that would be very attractive to bring companies to our state. To preserve our economy after a disaster, I encourage you to do whatever you can to help others understand how important this is, how a disaster resilient wellness program is key to Oregon's economy. Our private sector is depending on it so they can stay in business, so they can stay in Oregon, so which means the people stay here, which means they continue to own property, which means their kids stay in school, they continue to buy resources, and of course all of that helps us recover quicker. We are all in this together.
Thank you. Madam.
Good afternoon. My name is Sue Graves, and I'm a native Oregonian. My great-grandfather homesteaded on the mouth of the Salmon River, just north of Lincoln City. I was born in Newport, grew up in Depot Bay, the daughter of a fisherman. We didn't have tsunami maps at that time, but my mom and dad had a plan. If we felt the ground shake, we were to all jump in the station wagon, and we would hightail it up the hill to the top of Collins Street. That was our meeting place. Back in the late 60s and early 70s, our family had a tsunami plan. Today, I am the safety coordinator of Lincoln County School District. When I first started working there 12 years ago, I found out that we had three schools in the tsunami zone. I quickly learned some sobering things about the plan that they had in place. They did earthquake drills, they did tsunami evacuation drills, but their buildings were old and had high potential for collapse. The tsunami escape routes had regular slides on them every year with our winter storms. They weren't viable routes to escape from the tsunami. So I had candid talks with their teachers and told them, you're going to have to make some tough decisions. If this earthquake happens when you're in school, some of your kids are going to be trapped, and some of them will not be. And you're going to have to leave the ones that are trapped to try to help save the ones that are not trapped, because you have 15 minutes before the tsunami waves arrive and kill you and your students if you don't leave with them and lead them to safety and try to lead them to safety. These were not popular discussions. People were not ready to acknowledge the actual risks. There was a lot of denial. As a matter of fact, in 2005, I spoke out publicly at a board meeting about some of these risks, and the next day I was reprimanded. But a lot of things have changed since then. We have worked hard in Lincoln County to educate our citizens and to get ready for earthquakes and tsunamis. We've produced videos and educational materials. We've conducted numerous public education campaigns to raise awareness about the true risks of the Cascadia subduction zone. We've held citywide tsunami evacuation drills, and we've trained hundreds of citizens on how to prepare themselves and their families for earthquakes and tsunamis. Over time, the culture in Lincoln County has changed. We're no longer afraid to talk about the real risks that we face, and we are making progress to prepare for this catastrophic event. In fact, of our three schools in the tsunami zone, in 2006, we were able to reconfigure some of the other schools and close two of those schools, moving the kids out of the tsunami zone. And as you heard earlier, in May of 2011, Lincoln County voters approved a bond measure to build a school out of the tsunami zone for Walport High School. We're almost done building that school. In September, we will open the new school, and all of our kids will be out of the tsunami zone. It's a huge achievement. While discussing the implications of an earthquake and tsunami on the coast with police and fire partners, they told us, in reality, Sue, we are not going to be able to get to your kids to help them after this event. You're going to be isolated. You'll be on your own. And there will be many needs. Students will be injured. There will be collapsed buildings. But they said you have capable teenagers in your schools that if you provide training, they can be your emergency response team because they're right there with you. So we developed semester-long classes on disaster preparedness. They're called Teen Cert classes. And at our high school, students are taking classes to learn how to respond in a disaster and help our schools and our students survive. We are building capacity to respond to this disaster in our schools. In the past year, we have collaborated with our county, with our cities, with our fire districts, police stations, with businesses, with state and federal agencies, and we have raised thousands of dollars to build robust disaster supply caches that we are keeping at our schools. These supply caches will meet the basic immediate needs following the earthquake because we know that services aren't going to be there. We won't be able to turn on the faucet to get drinking water. We won't have adequate shelter. We won't have medical supplies. So we are working in collaboration with a lot of people to cache those supplies. It's exciting to see it coming together. Our next project is to seismically strengthen our coastal schools that are not in the tsunami zone. Several of our schools have been rated by Dogami as having a high or very high potential for collapse after this earthquake. When the ground starts shaking, students know what to do. They duck, cover, and hold. They practice these drills. But in reality, a lot of our buildings are still going to have major collapse. Students will be trapped and will be injured. And the fire department won't be able to get there to help us. They're not in the tsunami zone, which is good news, but the tsunami waves, surges, and hazardous materials that they carry with them will prevent anyone from coming to our rescue, leaving children trapped and injured with no help. If we seismically strengthen these schools, we will save lives, we will reduce injuries, and provide a place of refuge for children after this earthquake. Schools are the centerpiece of many coastal communities. They are essential to recovery and resilience. As students are able to go back to school after the earthquake and tsunami, parents can get back to work at rebuilding their communities and their lives. We know that it's only a matter of time before we have a large earthquake and tsunami. My parents planned for this event over 40 years ago. We are still working hard and planning for it now. The investment we make now will either serve us in our lifetime or be a gift to another generation. But there is much, much more to be done. It will take a deliberate effort, sacrifice, and strategic investment over the next 50 years to really position ourselves to not only survive this catastrophic event, but to recover in a timely manner and rebuild our communities. The Oregon coast is my home. I grew up there. My husband and I have raised our family there. It's an incredibly beautiful and wonderful place to live. My hope is that after today's testimony, you will make a plan and determine to make a significant action to position our communities to survive, rebuild, and recover. Thank you.
Questions, representatives? Senators, questions? Thank you very much. I appreciate it. C.J. Sylvester and Edward Wolf, if you would, please. I would just comment for the record, one of the things that came out as they talk about people preparing, you'll recall when the Japanese tsunami happened and we had the warning here, and Representative Boone will attest to this, a lot of people did follow the procedures and evacuated, and other people, for whatever stupid reason, went down to the beach and stood on the beach waiting for the wave to hit.
To watch it.
And unfortunately, first responders had to go recover them.
So not everybody's getting educated yet. Ladies first.
Good afternoon, Chairman, members of the committee. My name is C.J. Sylvester. I'm Chief Operating Officer of Portland Public Schools, 501 North Dixon Street in Portland. Just a few pieces of data for you. Portland Public Schools is the second largest property owner in the city of Portland after Portland Parks and Recreation. We own about 100 different sites with over 250 buildings on those sites, and the average age of our buildings is 65 years. I want to thank you for this opportunity to voice support for the recommendations of the Oregon Resilience Plan. As we listened to the desires of the Portland community prior to crafting our November 2012 capital bond ballot measure, we heard over and over that people are concerned about their children's safety in the event of an earthquake. And they are concerned that our schools will not be able to provide shelter following a major seismic event. Portland Public Schools buildings were crafted during earlier eras when seismic resistance was not part of our building code. A 2009 assessment of our schools identified a $400 million need solely for seismic upgrades, and that's after having already invested $50 million through our 1995 bond and other project work. In addition, our buildings have other significant physical and educational needs. This means we are not in a position to focus all of our resources simply on our school building structure. With our voter-approved 2012 bond, we have the ability to do incremental seismic strengthening at 26 schools. However, I would not want you to believe that these are complete seismic retrofits. They are not. We will have full modernization of three of our high schools and one K-8 to current structural code. We see earthquake safety as an integral part of our school modernization work efforts. It will take anywhere from another 3 to 5 decades to work through all of our school buildings, if our district's voters prove willing to support the capital funded needed to complete that work. The state's seismic rehabilitation grant program is dovetailed with our bond program on the seismic retrofit of Alameda Elementary School. Our bond dollars could be further leveraged by full funding of the SRG program, as recommended in the resilience plan. Imagine what we could do statewide with a one-to-one match of state to local dollars to prioritize structural improvements at our schools. The SRG program could further assist in building civic infrastructure, as is also recommended by the plan, by enhancing the seismic strengthening of school gymnasiums and cafeterias above code requirements to ensure they are safe havens for community residents in the event of a major disaster. Portland Public Schools is simply one school district in a state filled with schools that need a fully funded state rehabilitation grant program. A fully funded program would allow us to systematically proceed with the redevelopment of our school infrastructure to ensure a safe educational environment for our students and a civic safety net in the event of a major disaster. Your attention to this plan and its recommendations is deeply appreciated.
Thank you.
Chairman Boquist, Vice Chair Montes Anderson, Vice Chair Parrish, and members of the committee, I want to thank you for the opportunity to testify today on behalf of the recommendations and findings of the Oregon Resilience Plan. For the record, my name is Edward Wolfe from Portland. I'm a writer, and I served on the Portland Public Schools Long Range Facilities Plan Advisory Committee. I served on the advisory panel of the Oregon Resilience Plan, and along with a fellow Portland parent, Amanda Gersh, I co-founded a statewide parents initiative called Oregon Parents for Quake-Resistant Schools. As we've heard, resilience begins by protecting lives and by restoring commerce. In Oregon, we've heard plenty of evidence today that lots of places will be dangerous when we experience a magnitude 9 Cascadia subduction zone earthquake. There are really only two places where the state risks mass casualties, and one of them is the tsunami inundation zone, but the other is the state's 1,296 public schools. We know, and you've heard, that old, brittle buildings pose hazards to hundreds of thousands of Oregon school children. And I imagine all of you would agree that our schools should not be in the running to be Oregon's most dangerous place. They don't have to be. The state's capacity to advance the seismic resilience of Oregon schools is limited, but that capacity is not trivial. As you've heard, the Seismic Rehabilitation Grants Program, a small but innovative program established by the legislature, is the chief tool available. In the 4 years since the program was established, grants for safety investment have been made to 22 K-12 schools. Among those grants, two districts were districts with capital bonds in place where the seismic grants could work hand in hand with available capital funds. But in 13 school districts, no other capital bond and capital funds were in place to leverage the state grant funds. So I want to tell you a story about leverage. It's worth asking the question, when our resources are limited, how state funding can play a part, not just in correcting problems, but in attracting local resources and local funding to address the seismic need. Portland Public Schools had no capital bond in place when it sought and received the state seismic grant for Alameda Elementary School. That's the district's highest enrollment elementary school. The state grant did validate the district's decision to prioritize earthquake safety as it developed a bond proposal. And as you heard from Ms. Sylvester, that succeeded at the ballot box with a vote of about 2-1 in favor of Portland's $482 million bond. The state grant to Alameda, which was funded just last July, also will help us put bond funds to work more efficiently than would otherwise be the case. The point I'm making is that the state grant to Alameda through the Portland District primed the pump in a way that has direct benefits for taxpayers, for employment, and for the safety of our children. The timing in Portland's case was a happy coincidence, but there's no reason that that kind of synergy needs to be left to chance. Since its inception in 2009, the state grant program has funded retrofit projects in districts from Lakeview to North Clackamas, and that's a good start. We've got many, many facilities that are candidates for that funding, and growing the program deserves to be a centerpiece of resilience efforts. But aligning the program effectively with local districts' capital bond capacity and plans promises to accomplish even more, even faster. The state grant for Alameda didn't initiate concern for earthquake safety in the Portland District. To its credit, the district is probably the most progressive in Oregon in the duration of time it's attended to this risk. But it did leverage the local investment by emphasizing the story and by giving people a sense that dollars were already going to work. What it meant that every dollar of the state's investment in the state grant leveraged more than $321 in local funding for investment in school modernization. We know that resilience is going to require sustained investment. State and local initiatives have got to proceed hand in hand. And the Portland story shows one way that state resources can leverage the kind of local support that makes a big difference. The Oregon Resilience Plan is a blueprint and a roadmap for how you can find and capitalize on similar opportunities for leverage in state and local partnerships. And I appreciate your consideration of the plan. Thank you.
Thank you. Representatives, questions?
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I recognize that you may not be intimately familiar with the situation of many of the schools on our coast, but you talked about retrofit grants and similar kinds of programs. And I'm wondering, in the tsunami inundation zone, if it is a requirement that to receive grant money, that the school would have to be perhaps relocated to an elevation above the inundation zone.
I believe, Representative Witt, that you're correct that schools that are in the tsunami inundation zone are not candidates for funding from the Seismic Rehabilitation Grant Program, probably for the sensible reason that improving the structural safety of a school that would be wiped out by a tsunami would be a poor investment. It's a question of eligibility for funding that deserves a second look.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Senators, questions? Thank you very much. I appreciate. Do you have a question? Wait one.
No, I just want to thank you, Mr. Chair. I just wanted to point out that, Ted, thank you again. This all started with Ted and Jay, so almost 2 years ago now. But, so thank you for your advocacy and your tenacity and your forthrightness and all that, both of you.
Thank you.
It's all their fault.
Representative, it's not anybody's fault. We're all trying to work together and come up with this.
And you know, Sue came with the Japanese contingent when they visited my district. And thank you for coming today and for what you do.
Thank you. We're going to move on to utilities. Jack Varnish, Dave Ford, and Bruce Paskett, if you'd come up. And for the record, there are some members that are going to have to move on to other committees. If you're here for the healthcare committee, it's moving to room F. And we're going to continue to go through our agenda, and then those members that have to leave to other commitments, staff will then email them a link to the testimony so that they have that in their hands. And with that, gentlemen, you're getting blamed, so you're in.
Pointed at me first. Chair Boquist, Vice Chair Anderson, and Parrish, members of the committee. Thank you for the opportunity to testify today. My name is Jack Varnish. I'm the Director of Asset Management for PacifiCorp. As you may know, PacifiCorp serves approximately 555 customers in the state of Oregon, where we operate as Pacific Power. And as PacifiCorp, we serve more than 1.7 million customers across the western U.S. Our service territory spans 136,000 square miles, and we own over 16,000 miles of transmission and 62,000 miles of distribution lines. With such an extensive asset base, in order to provide reliable electric service to our customers, our company conducts ongoing planning to ensure that we are able to respond to emergencies in our service territory. And as part of our commitment to emergency preparedness, we participated in the OSPAC efforts as a member of the Energy Committee. As you have heard today, this committee identified a broad range of risk factors in the state that if a significant seismic event were to occur, one of those events they looked at, or risk factors the committee looked at, was how the electric grid would perform in such an event. And as called out in the report, with our current system, it is expected that in the event of a significant seismic event, our system will incur some damage, and outages will occur, and some of those may be extended. The extent of the damage, of course, will vary depending on the magnitude and location of the epicenter of the event, as well as local geologic conditions. In preparing for an event of this magnitude, we take a twofold approach. We look at what we call facility hardening, which is work we do to strengthen our facilities. And then we also look at how we can help recover in event of an event and what we can do to expedite recovery efforts. Regarding facility hardening, You know, PacifiCorp recognized the risk associated with seismic events in the early 1990s, and since that time, we've implemented seismic-specific design practices and methods into our construction of our facilities. And those methods have continued to evolve and improve over time as the industry becomes more aware of risk associated with seismic events. And as part of our hardening effort, as our facilities or equipment are upgraded or replaced or retrofitted, we bring them up to current design standards, or we retrofit them as practical to enable to improve their seismic resiliency. The OSPAC report mentioned a 50-year time frame to get Oregon resilient. And our infrastructure is an aged infrastructure, age profile, much like what you've seen on some of the other earlier presentations. As we replace those assets over the next, over a 50-year time frame, the vast majority of them will be brought up to, you know, standards, will be retrofitted or brought up to the standards in effect at the time. In addition to strengthening facilities, we've also looking, and we have added functionality, such as we've invested in redundant control centers, one located in Portland, one located in Salt Lake, where we can operate our entire electrical system from either of these facilities in if we were to lose one of them. So the other side of our response effort is looking at preparation and how we respond to an event. Pacific Power and the electric utility industry in general are somewhat unique than some of the other major infrastructure owners or providers in that we have a lot of experience in responding to natural disasters, whether they be hurricanes, ice storms, wind storms. Our emergency management plans get exercised in real-world events quite frequently. You know, we've utilized that experience within our company to plan and prepare for emergencies. And we work quite extensively with other government, other utilities and other government agencies to plan for emergencies. Within PacifiCorp, we operate in six western states. We have resources available across all those states to respond to an event of this magnitude. So we have the ability to bring in even our own internal resources from Idaho, Wyoming, Utah, Washington, to help us respond to an event. In addition to our own internal resources, we are a member of mutual assistance agreements. We have mutual assistance agreements in place with other utilities throughout North America to respond to an event. Recent example, as a member of a nationwide emergency response event, we helped respond to Hurricane Sandy on the East Coast and actually provided resources to them to aid in their recovery. Interesting event, probably the largest event the country has seen in the utility world for a long time, and a lot of lessons learned from that that event that that will under review and will be implemented throughout the industry. Some of the major concerns we have, as you've heard throughout the OSPEC process, we discuss the interdependence of different sectors of government agencies to ensure a coordinated response. And, you know, a quick response and recovery really requires everybody to be coordinated. I've heard about the issues with fuel. We cannot, you know, reach our customers if we don't have fuel. We can't respond to events if we don't have transportation routes to be able to get to our damaged facilities. We need communication systems up and running so we can communicate and coordinate response. So the coordination and the prioritization of that response effort is really essential to enabling the whole state of Oregon to recover in the event of this magnitude. Another issue is the electric, especially for the electric utility industry, we rely on our interconnected transmission system. It's an interconnected system throughout the western U.S., and there are many, many operators of that system. So in order to facilitate a quick response and mitigation efforts, all members of that people who participate in that system need to be involved in dealing and making Oregon more resilient. One of the issues the OSPAC report address was the need to do assessments, assess your facilities, and we support that approach, but one concern we have is that if assessments are performed, that there's a potential liability created there, and we would ask that any requirement to do assessments also be the issue of liability once those assessments are prepared be addressed in any action that is taken. As a company, Pacific Court, we have not assessed the incremental costs of this facility hardening effort or to improve the seismic resiliency of our facilities. If we were done over the 50-year period, a lot of that cost will really be won't be an incremental cost. It'll just be a cost of replacing our assets as they age or they need replacement for low growth or other issues. But again, we have not done a full assessment of that cost. So thank you for the opportunity to provide an overview of what Pacific Core is doing and our little bit on the electric industry in general. I'd be happy to answer any questions or if you'd like to wait till we're done.
I think we'll move across the panel, but before we go there, I do want to make two clarifying points. Just for the record, based on what you testimony you just given, and that is that the Oregon Resilience Plan does indicate that main grid repairs based on damage could last from anywhere to 7 to 51 days, and I like that on the record so that we know that it may not just be Pacific Corp or PGE or PUD. It may be a 51-day stretch before we even get main lines up and running. You know, worst case scenario. The second thing I do want to put on the record, because you raised this issue, is at a later date, we already have scheduled in a Senate hearing to discuss the liquid fuel issue, which, of course, nobody can move without fuel for vehicles, period. So I just wanted that on the record. Please go ahead. And again, there will be members that have to go out to other committee hearings. We are going to finish this. If you're here to talk about health, you're in hearing room F. Health has been moved to hearing room F. Please.
Chair Boquist, Chair Parrish. I read the little thing it says up here about how to manage the microphone, too.
If you speak too loud, we'll tell you to move back.
Thank you for the opportunity to testify. My name is Dave Ford. I'm with Portland General Electric, and I'm the Director of Business Continuity and Emergency Management. Again, thank you for inviting us to talk about the OSPAC report and the very real threat that we face in the Northwest, and specifically what it means to Oregon. You'll hear a lot of the things in my presentation that you heard in Jack's as well. PGE serves 825,000 customers, mainly in the North Willamette Valley. Our service area also includes those areas in which the bulk of the largest business organizations in Oregon reside, the largest city that is Portland, and we serve most of the state capital. With this in mind, we take very seriously the threat of major seismic event represents to the infrastructure and the impact that event would have to our customers. With that responsibility in mind, like Pacific Core and Northwest Natural, we participated in the OSPAC process. All three of the private sector, I'll emphasize private sector companies, have a long history of service in Oregon with extremely high levels of service reliability and customer satisfaction. We achieved those levels through good long-range planning and prudent investments working with the PUC. We've tracked the developments in local seismic research, and as you heard in the earlier presentations, that research really has developed over the last 25 years, and as Jack mentioned, our infrastructure has been built over the last 100 years or so. Our conclusions are drawn from this latest research, and adjustments to our facilities and plans have been ongoing. We've secured our large substation transformers, that is, tied them down. We've begun the process of reviewing our construction standards and methods in light of learnings from the other areas that have been impacted by similar events and what can be expected to happen to local energy infrastructure. We've adjusted our response plans and are in the process of building a new readiness center within our service territory in a much more seismically survivable location that will withstand the design event for that location and ensure the company critical processes and operations are resilient. We've conducted exercises within the company our latest last fall and have in place programs to ensure our employees are ready at home because they're our most critical resource and they need to be able to come back after an event. Many of our generation facilities are outside the area of significant impact as seen on the earlier maps and will likely be spared major damage. This is not to say we will not experience damage. I don't think you can engineer something such that nothing will happen. Our customers could not afford to harden the systems and processes such that no damage will occur. Our emphasis company-wide has been to ensure that we are resilient, that we can come back from that damage in a reasonable period of time. As Pacific Corps mentioned, we will need to rely on other infrastructure to be in place in short order in order for us to be able to respond. Fuel, communications, transportation have been mentioned. Also, I will mention from an electrical perspective, our regional or near-regional partners will need to be brought up in order for us to be able to respond to the regional event. Specifically, BPA is the most critical of that process in that group. If we do one thing to improve the state's ability to respond and recover from a major seismic event, it would be to ensure ongoing coordination among all the responders and service providers. This coordination should be at the senior policy level as well as the operational level. In order to be effective, there will need to be a cohesive and effective, and I might add, well-exercised process for setting regional policies and priorities due to the inevitable situation of limited resources. We need only look to the events surrounding the recent Hurricane Sandy response to see the effects of poor regional cooperation, and they knew that event was coming days, if not weeks, in advance. Through our National Association, we know that the response was not quick, and it could have been, as it could have been, due to the questions regarding who was in charge and a prioritized system for rationing things like fuel. It's important to note as well that although PGE, Pacific Corps, and Northwest Natural participated in the OSPAC process, none of the smaller organizations across the state did. Munis, PUDs, co-ops did not, and they represent a fairly large geographic area in the state, if not a large population. We look forward to continued discussion on this topic and have started conversations with the PUC, which is the right place for regulated entities like PGE and others represented here on this panel to discuss plans and investments to increase system resiliency and preparedness. But be assured, we will continue to prepare as we have in the past. Thank you for the time.
You're up.
Okay. Last but not least, Chair Boquist.
Your stuff blows up, so we want to hear about it.
Okay. And that concludes my remarks for today. Chair Boquist, Vice Chair Parrish, and honorable committee members. My name is Bruce Paskett. I'm the Principal Compliance Engineer for Northwest Natural Gas. I appreciate the opportunity today to give you Northwest Natural's perspectives on seismic preparedness and the Oregon Resilience Plan. Just by way of background, Northwest Natural is the largest natural gas distribution company in the state of Oregon. We own and operate some 630 miles of natural gas transmission lines and over 13,000 miles of distribution mains to serve over 680,000 customers in our region, which is Oregon and Southwest Washington. Out of those, about 90% of those facilities and customers are located in Oregon. The company is committed to safe, reliable, cost-effective delivery of natural gas to our customers. And I'm happy to report today that we've made significant progress toward improving the seismic resilience of the natural gas infrastructure. And we're further committed to improving our resilience in a reasonable, practical, and cost-effective manner that recognizes the impacts to our utility ratepayers. Since 1983, Northwest Natural has worked closely with the OPUC pipeline safety staff to design and implement pipeline safety programs that exceed both state and federal pipeline safety regulations. In my opinion, these programs have produced two major benefits for the state, the first of which is a significant improvement in pipeline safety for our infrastructure, and second, as a significant improvement also in seismic resilience. And on your handouts, there's a list of a number of those programs. In the interest of time, I won't go through those in detail. But again, beginning in 1983, we've taken very aggressive action in replacement of some of that infrastructure, such as cast iron mains that might not resist a seismic event very well. As a result of this aggressive enhanced pipeline safety programs, Northwest Natural Transmission and Distribution Pipelines actually are essentially 100% constructed of modern-day materials, both welded steel and polyethylene plastic, that have a high amount of ductility. In non-engineering terms, that would say flexibility, that would, yeah, there you go. It'll give a lot, if
That's
you will,
right.
To respond favorably to a seismic event. There's been a significant amount of research and analysis from previous earthquake events that's concluded that the modern materials that our system is made up of, the arc welded steel and the polyethylene plastic pipelines, will perform very well during seismic events. And as one of the elements of Northwest Natural's enhanced pipeline safety programs, we have geotechnical engineers have evaluated the entire transmission pipeline rights of way to look for geohazards or unstable ground locations. Well, I'm pleased to report today that we've made considerable progress. There's still work to be done. So our path forward includes a strategy, as you've heard from my esteemed colleagues on the panel, to include improvements to our critical facilities in conjunction with effective response, which really means an orderly shutdown, repair, and restoration. Part of the recommendations that you'll find in the Energy Task Group is a strategy that includes identification of both critical energy infrastructure facilities and the evaluation of potential vulnerabilities and development of mitigation plans on those facilities. To support the proposal from my esteemed colleagues, the Energy Task Group report included also, amongst the 10 recommendations, a recommendation that the state should provide some level of immunity, statutory immunity, and liability with respect to that identification of critical structures and their potential vulnerabilities. In addition to that identification of facilities, Northwest Natural is moving forward at this point in time with the installation of remote control valves at critical locations in our facilities to facilitate an effective response. The expanded use of excess flow valves, which will actually protect natural gas service lines in the case of a building is not seismically designed and it falls on our service system. And we have moved forward, as others on the panel have reported, with mutual aid agreements so we can call in qualified workers, materials, and equipment from across the entire country. You've already heard a lot from this panel about critical interdependencies and factors, which includes coordination of other stakeholders. I'll add one to the list, which in our case, even though we have on-system storage capability for natural gas, our response is also dependent on a timely restoration of service by the Interstate Natural Gas Transmission Pipeline supplier. You've also heard, and we share the concerns about the ability for our crews to access the transportation infrastructure, which is to say roads and bridges, liquid fuel, and communications systems. One other concern that I will share, a personal concern on my part, is a statutory relief or waiver from routine permit requirements in the restoration. So we think it's critical that in the event of a disaster, there's some kind of a mechanism to waive or streamline permitting requirements so that you don't have the responders, the utilities that are attempting to restore service, but they're hampered by prolonged permitting analyses and requirements. To summarize my comments today, Northwest Natural's enhanced pipeline safety programs have significantly improved both pipeline safety and seismic resilience. In a different term, to follow up on the earlier presentation, we think we're well through the initial bites of the elephant, but we have to finish up the meal. New and replaced pipeline facilities are designed to a high level of seismic resilience. We intend to implement additional actions to further improve our resilience with support from the relevant regulatory agencies. And we will, as the other colleagues on the panel have reported, we're going to rely heavily on mutual aid agreements to respond to a seismic event. That concludes my comments today, and I'd be happy to field any questions you might have.
Madam Vice Chair.
Thank you. So I don't pretend to be any kind of energy expert, not what I went to school for, but I had some folks in my office this morning, and it kind of got me thinking as you were talking. There are some bills the legislature is considering that certainly affect your industry, and as if those bills should pass, they spike the fuel, you know, energy prices go up. What does that do to your ability to generate capital for infrastructure development, and in the case of some type of catastrophe, the ability to have the resources on hand to actually rebuild us?
Who did you want to field that question?
Paper, scissors.
Well,
You're all warmed up.
I'm all warmed up. Okay. Since I am not familiar with exactly the bills that you were discussing this morning, I'll speak from a perspective of general terms, and that is there is a, you know, the three folks that are at the table, our companies are all regulated utilities, regulated by the Public Utility Commission, and so there is a process in place for us to go through rate making, or rate cases to recover prudently incurred costs. So I think the short answer to that is, to the extent that the PUC finds these costs for seismic resilience improvements, et cetera, are prudently incurred, then that would be decided by the commission.
More or less, we're paying. We're paying through rate increases.
It's ratepayer money when the day is done. So I don't know if that helps or not.
I'd add to that that the the magnitude of the investment that we're talking about over 50 years, if that were accelerated, I'm not sure there'd be a lot of appetite in our ratepayers' attitudes to pay for that on the short term. That's why we're all endorsing a long-term approach to this, a programmatic approach to the assessment and the improvement of the infrastructure. To the degree that there are other bills, and again, I'm not familiar with those, with what they are, but if they limit our access to capital, that drives our costs up, cost of getting, of borrowing money, makes it tougher on our business.
So. I had PUDs in my office this morning.
Yeah.
Some of the bills that are coming forward, and that they felt like that, you know, I got the sense that some of those bills would, increase the cost that you'd have to give to ratepayers, which potentially could, you know, slope demand down, and mm-hmm. you know, those dollars that you're amortizing over time mm-hmm. suddenly not available to you over a period of years. So I guess that's.
But since you bring those up, mentioned that none of the PUDs or munis were involved in the OSPAC. Process, and quite frankly, they tend not to have the same level of engineering design resources to manage this increase in resilience that, say, some of the larger companies do. That's an issue.
Yeah, those places are on, like, yeah, right. Neighborhoods.
You had a question, Representative?
I do. Thank you, Mr. Chair, and we'll make sure that they get involved with that, because this is just the starting point. I wanted to apologize. I have to leave. They're waiting for me in another committee to vote on three bills, but it should be quick.
Oh, no.
I'll be back. I don't want you to think I'm leaving. I'd really rather stay here. But one of them is my bill. As back as soon as possible.
I was going to let you go, but I do have a question, because you raised the issue here, and I think it points out. I think it's a fair assumption to say, and I'm looking to the chief authors over here, that since the rural PUDs were probably developed during the rural electrification program, chances are that their infrastructure is older than those of the PUC commissions. And I don't know if the authors of the report and were involved in the process, but is that a correct assumption that probably most of the PUDs which of course came about from the rural electrification, are going to have older infrastructures?
I would say that they were developed about the same time, and they've got maintenance programs as well as we do. It just happens to be we are a larger area, or larger service territories, but our company is 125 years old, so it's been around for a long time. And like we, like they, there's improvements going on in their infrastructure.
I would say that probably generally, you know, they tend to serve rural areas which have seen less growth, so there's probably been less new construction driven because of driven through growth purposes anyway. So.
Right. I appreciate it. Thank you very much. Appreciate your input. We're going to move on to the Red Cross, if we would, and then a couple things to put on the record. You will call those in the audience and members of the public that there were pictures from the presentation from Dr. Yu and Mr. Wilson that showed bridges that fell on into the off the into river, so on and so forth. And I just remind everybody that gas lines, some of these lines go across these bridges, so when the bridges fall, the lines fall too. Also, we will be addressing for members of the public each chapter by chapter in the report later in May and in June, and making implementation recommendations. And though we won't have committee statutory authority, we do have the presiding officer on the Senate committee, so we can have chats with Ways and Means to put budget notes in. So we have a mechanism in place to ensure we start down the road chapter by chapter for the implementation. And with that, I think we're beyond 72 hours of planning now.
Good afternoon, Chair Boquist, Chair Parrish. I appreciate the opportunity to be here today. My name is Marie Wacker. I'm the Regional Executive CEO for the American Red Cross in Oregon. And sitting next to me is our Chief Operating Officer, Eric Corliss. We have appreciated the opportunity to participate with OSPAC. And we believe the recommendations in the report respond to the requests made by House Resolution 3. The report summarizes the threat and the danger we face. Increasing that danger, in our opinion, is the fact that Oregonians as individuals are unprepared. We're distributing to you a survey we conducted last summer, which I think will drive home that point very specifically about the state and lack of preparedness on an individual citizen basis. For the Red Cross, resilience is a factor of prepared individuals, communities, schools, and organizations in addition to the built environments and infrastructure addressed in the report. Therefore, my comments today relate to the citizen component of resilience that we feel you must also address. Before I do that, I'll take a moment to recommend this book, The Unthinkable, by Amanda Ripley. I believe I've given you one, Representative Boone, which, in effect, is a study of who and how people survive great catastrophic disasters. And it truly is a case statement for the fact of what needs to be done for addressing citizen preparedness in our community. I think the other case statement, obviously, is that of, and this week we are honoring both the survival and the hard work that Japanese citizens did to survive their event, which it was a factor of their work in changing their culture over decades and hundreds of years, even in some cases, to having individual preparedness be actually the way they live their lives. I also have provided you a copy of our survey, as I said. Preparedness has a high return on investment. In fact, the Federal Emergency Management Agency states that $1 paid in preparedness saves $4 in response. The World Bank puts that ratio at $1 to $7. Some of the comments you heard today earlier about making the changes in the infrastructure now as you're building are so much easier and more cost-effective than making them or having to respond to them after an event has occurred. The business continuity and continuity of local government operations is dependent on the concept that an individual preparedness is an important factor in an organization's ability to resume operations and, indeed, a society's ability to survive. With that in mind, we have constructed the preparedness schema in the following manner. Essentially, key components of individual preparedness from a Red Cross perspective are that individuals and families have a plan. They know what they're going to do in the event. They have emergency plans, emergency contacts, emergency location plans among their family. Individuals have training in first aid and CPR. As you've heard today, our roads will definitely be a problem, and therefore expecting emergency responders to get to people who need help is pretty unlikely. And the fact of the matter that we will be our own first responders. In addition, the training that we believe people need to have related to what does it mean to be prepared needs to occur. We also were pleased to see the recommendations in the report about beginning teaching preparedness at the school level in the K-12 environment. It is a practice that the Japanese Society has had for a very long time, and it is one that we believe will do the best thing possible in getting Oregon resilient. And having a kit is kind of last on the list for the individual. It's not enough to just have a kit. There's so much more that has to be done. Key components of community preparedness from a Red Cross perspective are that individuals are prepared, as I've suggested above, but then communities have a plan, a specific plan specific to their community about how they will respond. That the community has trained volunteers who understand what their work will need to be in the event of a response. That they've identified shelters in their community and the unique community resources that they would put to work to respond in an effort. In this fashion, I often think of Commissioner Labhart in Tillamook County, who often talks about the fact that they're going to use their milk trucks for water. You know, that's an asset that community has, that a lot of communities across the state, when they really got to thinking about what their unique preparedness plan might be, would also be able to fold into a plan if they thought ahead of time. And last but not least, a community prepared requires engaged organizations and businesses in solving those challenges. In our opinion, key components of statewide preparedness from our perspective is, again, individuals are prepared as above, communities are prepared as I've said, but it's been our experience that providing information, encouraging change, supporting guidelines does not motivate significant and necessary change in behavior. We have been doing this very thing for years. As yet, it is noted in our survey that the last 8 years have produced the most monumental natural disasters our country has seen in other parts of the world. And yet, we have hardly moved the needle at all in 8 years with the disasters we have faced. So therefore, it is our opinion and our recommendation that tough and brave and perhaps politically unpopular decisions and investments will need to be made in order to assure that we become a truly resilient Oregon. We wholeheartedly concur with the recommendation of the Building Task Group in the OSPAC report that a State Office of Resilience be established, and that a office includes providing leadership and policy for the education and motivation of individuals to take responsibility for their own survivability. While the report recommendations have a 50-year horizon, individual education and motivation, as we've suggested today, can start tomorrow, and that cost is very reasonable. I would be pleased in the future, we would be pleased to work with you moving forward, and thank you for this opportunity.
Representative Boone, Vice Chair, questions?
I have one question.
Sure.
I understand what you're saying here. You know, fear scares the hell out of people, and until you start talking about doom and gloom, they don't do anything. So, and sometimes, as I point out, they walk to the beach, and they watch the wave as it rolls over them. And I remember there was a movie about that, right? Fell from the beach and watched the wave walk over. And might be stupid, but just because it's stupid, some people are going to do it anyway. But how do, in your mind, we have to move from the 72-hour traditional planning model to 14 days, probably, minimum.
Right.
You know, at least on this side of the mountain, and really on the other side of the mountain, because everything that they're getting, we're going to take and push forward. So they're going to last for 14 days, too, just the way the life goes. And I don't know what your organization is doing, but how we start to educate people at that, to say, you know, you got to stop planning for 72 hours. I mean, it's going to be 14 days.
Right.
You know, and it's going to be easy
for many entities to turn around and say, well, PGE isn't getting its power. And it's like, well, I hate to tell you, and we haven't heard from them, and they're on my list for later this spring, is that, okay, how many cracks are we going to have in those dams up the river? And how many, you know, turbines are going to get kicked out of tilter? And so is there going to be not only getting the grid structure back up and all those towers that are on liquefied stratification too, but, you know, so it's going to be a long time, even in Portland.
Yes.
And as you know, in my district, I have a few cities, and they think that Safeway grows fruit every 3 days. and so I have a price problem. But what are you guys doing to try and expand it? I've seen some of the Red Cross, I don't know what Oregon is doing specifically, but some of the states have moved to saying 7 days. You know, don't plan for the old 72 hours, plan for 7 days. What are you folks doing and preaching?
For the last 2 years, we have said 3 weeks.
Okay.
And it's consistent with what the resilience plan has recommended as well. So we were pleased to see that. We have community disaster education courses that we provide free of charge. They're supported by the generous donations of the public.
Mm-hmm.
We also have a program called Ready Rating, which is a program for businesses to actually go online and take a 123-point assessment of their state of preparedness.
Mm-hmm.
And then the report will give them back a list of the things, a rating, and a list of the things that they need to do to become more prepared. And then they can go back the following year and put in what they've done, and then it'll give them the next stage recommendations. So we do have some tools in the Red Cross that work at that very baseline level.
Appreciate that. 21, I was wrong, not 14, 21 days. Now, if I could just get a few of those Democrat lawyers in the House to start planning, storing beer for 21 days, we might get their votes for this. Right? So, as you say, there's tough decisions. I appreciate that.
As long as we can have our own power source, we can make it in Cannon Beach. We got two brew pubs there.
As long as the military department can fly you fuel, you're good for your generator.
There, okay. We'll work together.
We don't own enough helicopters, I hate to tell you. So thank you very much. I appreciate your testimony. And I'm going to ask the first three agencies to come up, and we're going to move forward. DGAMI, LCDC, and Department of Transportation. I always love the Department of Transportation because the bridges just get more numerous, not less numerous, that are going to hit the water. So bring some chairs up with you. I apologize for screwing up your day, but we decided it would be better to get it all on record at one point, and then we're, as again, the various committees are going to move backwards chapter by chapter as we go forward at a later point. Do we have slides, or?
Chair Bilquist.
You know I'm familiar with the doom and gloom, so.
Excuse me?
I'm familiar with the doom and gloom.
Yeah. I'm sorry, I just still didn't catch that.
I'm familiar with the doom and gloom, so.
Okay, doom and gloom. No doom and gloom. Chair Bilquist, Representative Parrish, I had prepared a PowerPoint presentation, but in the interest of time, I'll be happy to just walk
Summer,
you through the high points here.
If you do that, because we're going to have you back.
Okay, great. So the first point that I wanted to make, first off, my name is Ian Maiden. I'm chief scientist with the Oregon Department of Geology and Mineral Industries, and I'm here representing Dr. Vicki McConnell, the agency director. The first point I wanted to make was that evaluating earthquake hazards and tsunami hazards and helping to promoting the mitigation of those hazards and performing outreach to the public and institutions on those hazards are actually explicit statutory duties of DGAMI. Those are actually listed in our enabling statute as specific items. And the next point I wanted to make is that in our current strategic plan, we have numerous objectives that, again, specifically address the issue of evaluating earthquake hazards, tsunami hazards, and doing outreach and mitigation of both of those kinds of hazards. We have been working on earthquake hazards, and particularly on Cascadia subduction zone issues, since 1987, when the first evidence appeared that such earthquakes were possible in Oregon and could be as large as magnitude 9. Over that time, we've done literally dozens of projects. Most of those projects have been centered around mapping or assessing tsunami hazards and the effects of soil and geology on ground shaking and liquefaction and landslides in Oregon urban areas. So we're trying to evaluate the extent of the geologic hazard. And then we've also done quite a bit of work on trying to estimate losses, assess the risk, and to help develop policy to try to mitigate that risk. Most of that activity has been funded by FEMA, USGS, some cities, some counties, a little bit of lottery money over the course of the years. Most of those projects, however, were done
specifically as contracts with outside agencies, outside organizations. Currently, we have two active projects in the earthquake and tsunami arena. We are just completing a four-year program to do a complete remapping of the tsunami inundation zones along the Oregon coast and a complete new set of tsunami evacuation maps for all Oregon coastal communities. That's been a four-year project funded with almost $3 million worth of funding from the National Tsunami Hazard Mitigation Program administered by NOAA. That program comes to an end at the end of this current biennium. And we see no current prospect for future funding from that program. The Tsunami Hazard Mitigation Program has not been reauthorized by Congress. No prospect that that will happen. So we expect to be out of the tsunami business as of July 1 of this year. One of the most important parts of that tsunami program has been an aggressive public outreach program. We've had people stationed in various coastal communities now for several years going literally door-to-door, trying to educate people, organize evacuation drills. That will all cease. The only other projects that we're working on currently are a couple of hazard assessments for the Portland area. One is producing a new set of very detailed geologic geotechnical maps that the USGS will use to map shaking from future subduction zone earthquakes in the Portland urban area. And we're also studying landslide hazards in the Clackamas County area, and that includes an earthquake hazard evaluation. So currently, we've just got those two or three projects. They all end at the end of this year. But we have a long list of places that we would like to go and a long list of things that we think need to be done. And we are very pleased when the resilience plan was finished to find that virtually everything we think needs to be done is listed in the resilience plan as an important project. So the kinds of things that we're interested in doing are extending the tsunami program to modeling evacuation times for communities, providing modeling of the nearshore environment and port facilities so that the maritime community knows where to evacuate to and what conditions will be like in port areas for hours after the event. We want to collect geologic data, data about buildings, data about lifelines, infrastructure, so that we can make better loss estimates from the future Cascadia subduction in earthquakes so that people have a better sense as to where the problems are. And we want to continue to provide policy advice and to do outreach and mitigation efforts throughout the state. And that's what we have for you today.
Thank you.
Chair Boquist, I am Matt Krall. I'm at the Department of Land Conservation and Development. And with me today is my colleague, Patty Snow, who is in charge of our Ocean and Coastal Division. I'll start off today and just sort of outline some of the areas we're involved, and then you can tell me which of those you want to hear more about when we come back later. DLCD operates kind of on two levels. One is a very specific or maybe narrow level of land use, urban growth boundaries and zoning, but we also operate on a broader level of comprehensive planning with the 19 statewide planning goals and trying to collaborate interagency and with local collaboration. And it's in that broader role, really, that we're involved in these kinds of things. And I want to hit two pieces that we're working on. One is the statewide hazard mitigation plan. This is an all-hazards plan. It involves work of many agencies. It is something that our department is taking on as the coordinating role in this next biennium. It is required by FEMA that we do this plan. However, we have a lot of flexibility what we put in it to make it work for what we need in Oregon to incorporate the kind of things that are in this resiliency plan. And the first step we'll be doing that is a risk assessment where we'll try to make things a little more specific as far as where these specific risks go. Take it down one level in detail from this general plan and the resiliency, but we can't get all the way down to local level at this statewide plan. But we can at least prioritize those areas where we need to do more research and those places where mitigation spending would really pay off. That's what we want to do with that plan. The second aspect I want to talk about DLCD is the relationship that we have with local governments. We work with all of the cities and counties in their comprehensive plans, and through Goal 7, they all are adopting local hazard mitigation plans and trying to address these. Our role with them is primarily to help and support them. We have some technical support. We have limited amounts of grant funding to use. And we do have, as I said, the Goal 7 has a process for bringing in new information. This was not something that was done as part of most comprehensive plans when they were prepared in the late 70s and early 80s, obviously. So we were thinking about how do you incorporate new information into there. That's most of what I have to talk about today. And if I, Patty has a few things to share, and then...
A little crowded up here. Chair Broquist.
It's no going to be crowded after the earthshakes, too, so get used to sharing.
For the record, I'm Patty Snow, Coastal Program Manager at DLCD. I just wanted to add some of the things we're working on in the Coastal Program. We are really engaged to try and help local governments address tsunamis in particular. We've contracted with a consultant for a guide. It's called Preparing for a Cascadia Event Tsunami, a Land Use Guide for Local Communities. And we're happy to say that we believe that all the recommendations that are in the Resiliency Plan that deal with land use in the coastal area are going to be addressed in the guide. So we're pretty we're looking forward to having that out. We believe that should be done the end of June this year. We're also we'll be taking our field reps. We have folks that deal with all the local coastal communities, and they'll be taking the Resiliency Plan out to local governments. And the other thing I wanted to mention was a project we're working on in the North Coast. It's a resiliency project that we were successful in getting a grant to work with Clatsop County and the cities of Gearhart, Seaside, and Cannon Beach. And it will be, this will be over the next 2 years. We're working with those communities to establish a low-cost approach to improve community resiliency to natural hazards. And this is all hazards, but certainly tsunamis will be a large part of that. It will also be involving community members and planning for multiple hazards and establishing a network to help communities prepare for and ultimately recover from natural hazards, including earthquakes, tsunamis, and floods. So, and we're applying actually for another grant that would be looking at resiliency, a hazard assessment actually for the entire coastal zone. So we're hoping to get that. We should hear about that this spring. So we're involved with a number of projects on the coast to deal with tsunamis and hazards. And be glad to answer any questions today or in the future.
LCDC question. Fire away.
I wish I would have waited on that phone call interview with OPB. I could have said one of her questions was, how is it being taken and what are people going to do? So maybe I can call her back, Patty. Thank you. Sure. But I have to say it's really nice to hear that agencies have been doing this and they're working forward. We're going to have a huge issue in getting the public involved as far as outreach. So that's part of your charge, too.
Statewide planning goal one.
What's that?
Public involvement.
All right.
A couple takeaways for LCDC before we go on, because as I say, we're going to come back to this. Due to the good efforts of Senator Verger and Representative Cowan from 2005 until now, the public did approve a constitutional change that can allow the governor to make a declaration of emergency, gives him broader powers in such a declaration of emergency. I don't need to tell you the conspiracy theory problems we had with that bill for 5 or 6 years coming through. Having said that, though, no one at this point, and it's not necessarily OEM or the military department's responsibility, but it comes back to mitigation, FEMA liability planning, and that's the issue is when it happens, because we know it's going to happen, and you've heard some of the testimony here, what recommendation is going to be made for the governor in what land use laws, what regulations, and what things are we going to waive temporarily that allows us, for better word, to hack our way to the coast, okay, and reopen the roads. And there's a whole huge list of there. And in that same thing is the insurance liability issue. And we cannot do that through ways and means. If we have to, in order to advance on planning and mitigation planning and asset risk planning, so on and so forth, over the next 18 months, if there is liability issues that our PUCs, our local governments, and everybody else might be facing, that we have to solve before the end of session. And that's got to be done really in the next 4 to 6 weeks. And I see heads shaking back there to understand what I'm saying. And what I'm really driving at is there are those liability issues that the Oregon Resilience Plan raise for the next planning phases. And because I'm not stupid, the trial lawyers are listening too, is if some entity says this is a risk and we recognize it, but it's a 50-year risk, they're suddenly going to be able to be sued if the 9-0 happens next week. And that's one of the issues that I think the insurance issue. But, and I'm not sure that's an LCDC issue so much, but the constitutional piece is, and that is what is our plan now? What is our statewide plan? When it shakes, what is going to be recommended to the governor? And what are we going to waive? What things are we going to have to do? And it basically falls right into the FEMA mitigation plan right there. So there's a take home for you.
Thank you.
And We'll go on to ODOT.
Well, I just wanted to add, thank you, Mr. Chair. You might want to look back at in 2005, 7, 9, all those, I think year before 12 was the only one we didn't have a committee with emergency prep in it. It's been with veterans. It's been with ocean policy. There's been quite a few bills over the years that have to do with this, and some of those questions may be answered. I know that I do remember that battle, but there were a lot of things we considered. Some got halfway through, some made it all the way through, but they're all very important issues, and if you could peel the politics out of them, you know, they make a lot of sense, and that's what frustrates me, is that that's what we need to do, because I tell everybody this, read that book called The Postman by David Brin. That's what it's going to be like.
It's a great movie, too,
though. A different movie, I mean, but you're right.
ODOT.
Chair Boquist, Representative Boone, Paul Mather, Highway Division Administrator for ODOT. With me is Bruce Johnson, our state bridge engineer. Just going to be brief on issues concerning transportation. Obviously, you've heard throughout the various testimony today, transportation is key to our response as well as to our recovery. This is more than what's going to affect just 101. It's going to affect all of Western Oregon, and virtually every state highway within Western Oregon is going to be impassable. We've been doing a lot of work the last two decades to incorporate seismic into our seismic design into our design of our various projects, and doing what we can with our resources on doing retrofits to our existing bridges, but we're still way behind where we need to be. We've been doing some strategic planning work around how to approach this problem, and I look forward to coming back and talking to you more about that. Really focused our efforts on strategic lifeline routes, similar to what we did with our OT03 bridge program, where we focused on freight routes for trucks. Here we're focusing on, obviously, the lifeline routes that the state needs to, again, respond and recover to this catastrophe. We've also applied our economic model that we used in the OT03 bridge program and really asked the question, what is the economic damage that would happen with an event like this? If you look at the routes that would be affected, in our estimates of anywhere from a matter of months to up to 5 years to getting those routes back open again, the total economic damage over a 10-year period to the state is roughly $350 billion. We think with our investment that we're coming up with in a strategic way, we can take 25% off of that damage, the long-term economic damage to the state. And so your return on investment for upgrading the bridges on the state highway would be a 46-to-1. Or in other words, every dollar you invest, you would have a $46 savings long-term economically. So again, look forward to coming back, kind of walking you through what our plans are and some of the details of some of those numbers, and look forward to the recommendations that are in the resilience plans and those recommendations.
We'll have to just make sure that the rest of the committee hears that. We might have got everybody depressed at the beginning of this session, but now we're bringing them back up because this is good news. Thank you.
Right. And I need to publicly thank ODOT. I mean, between 2005, when Senator Verger and I co-chaired it, and we came out of the Stone Age and saying, hey, you know, just getting everybody to understand the earth would really shake at 9-0 was quite a challenge. And ODOT has done a tremendous amount of lifting and identifying bridges, developing partnerships, and we know it. The weak link that we don't have an answer for is fuel for ODOT trucks and fuel for PGE and Northwest Natural and ambulances and emergency centers and county emergency centers. And
but in my other committee, we're working on this, we call it the French fry bill, so stay tuned. We'll get it there.
Right. We're going to put biofuel stations outside of every one of them, right?
I wanted, Mr. Chair, if you would just indulge me one second.
We're doing this for you anyway, so.
I know. Thank you. Continue the indulgement, but and I do thank you for that. But a very key person could not be here today, and that's Dr. Vicki McConnell, the director of DOGAMI. She is back in Washington, D.C., fighting for the tsunami warning system, among other things. Ian probably knows more than I do about why she's there, but she had to be gone. She left Sunday or Saturday, so she would have been here. She was a big part of this, too. So, but this what really is heartening to me is that, you know, we've been doing this since 2005, trying very hard to get things going, and with this plan that really helps, thanks to the Jay and Ted again, and thanks to everybody who what they're doing, they're on their own, they're not waiting to be told this is what you have to do. And so I think it's coming together, And I'm looking forward to it. I know that I learned a lot about all our agencies in the early 2000s having their own disaster plans because they were told to. And, you know, the utilities, everybody's been on board. This was not news to them. So we really appreciate it. It's kind of nice to all be working together. And you'll all get a thank you from me. It's just going to take some time. There's a lot of people.
And for the Senate, we need to thank Representative Boone because we started in 2005 with this. And I remember me going back and briefing Karen Minnis and at that time Senator Verger, my co-part, going back and briefing Senator Courtney. And they go, this costs how much? And who else knows anything about this? And I actually remember being summoned a year ago to the floor of the House to explain to my colleagues, you know, the doom and gloom and necessary to move something. And I felt like the lone wolf out there. And so my hat is really off to Kent, you and Jay Wilson to find 160 or 70 people to sit down, citizens, at almost no cost to the state government, identify a plan that's a citizen's plan for a citizen legislature to use to try and move our way forward. And I think, my hat's off. I'm sure some of them didn't want to go to all of the state employees and agencies that participated in this, and even more so to the businesses that got drug into this thing, and the light has gone on, and everybody's starting to do it. I have a couple of takeaways from this that I see for staff in that, you know, we don't have a real, I don't see it or it's in here. BPA is a big player, and we don't have an answer for that one yet. And also fuel for trucks. We don't have a big answer for that one. But we have that hearings. The fuel industry is committed to finding some answers. They participated in some of the work groups that you guys had, and they're coming back with that. But as I said, the 2020, the short range goal, I was going to say 25-meter target, comes from my military background, but is that we have to address some of the liability issues immediately in present legislation as we go forward. That then gives us the tools to go forward. And I did ask, and I got a commitment, I believe, from Dr. Yu for participation from the resilience plan drafters and the task force and group and the commission to come back as we address each of these chapters as we go forward, because it's the intent of the Senate side to be able to identify things that we can do now, work with our agencies and identify things that we can start working together forward immediately to start implementing it, because the clock should have started probably in my mind in 2005, which would have put us about 8 years into the 50-year model, and we'd be at 42 years, and you guys would already have those bridges down less than 352. And I understand the deal. With that, Representative Boone, I think we've indulged you with as much time as we can give you.
I totally appreciate it, and I agree, and the House will join you in that effort.
I'm lucky that I have the presiding officer in my committee, and so I will look forward to your commitment from the House on that side.
Okay.
And with that, I appreciate, again, everybody coming. I appreciate if members of the public that are out there, we're going to have hearings on each of the chapters of this as we move forward, and we'll have public testimony. We've put the good work of the Oregon Seismic Safety Policy Advisory Commission on the record now, and now we have until the end of July to make some progress forward. And with that, the meeting for the day is over.
So do I have to